Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
I wish I was in Dixie. Away, away. We down south in Dixie. Bring the niggas with the banjos. Send in the clowns.
Oh, I wish I was in the land of
to police, Jedman, with two teenage girls as his passengers, drove to a local McDonald's meeting up with the rest of the group. There, according to witnesses interviewed by police, he said, "I ran that nigger over."
He was not remorseful. He was laughing. Laughing about the killing.
Context of white supremacy, Gus T. Renegade, in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Monday, May 30th, 2016. So I have been told, so-called Memorial Day in certain spots on the planet. Hope folks have been constructive and been able to successfully navigate the weekend. I know a lot of people had a day away from the plantation today or over the weekend or however, whatever white people permitted for you or any other non-white people. I hope you did not take that opportunity to cut a fool and be intoxicated and engage in a lot of non-constructive activity. Regardless of what the date on the calendar, we still want to be as constructive as possible and really make every effort to maximize our use of time and energy. We have way too many problems as black people to be pausing to celebrate barbecue, any other silliness on the plantation. We should be trying to solve problems, end racism, white supremacy immediately. Moving forward, Puff was on the program with us, the compensatory broadcast this past Saturday. She asked about what specific broadcast. When it was mentioned, we were talking about Michelle Alexander, who is a victim of white supremacy, non-white female, but she does have a white parent. She wrote The New Jim Crow. We were talking about some of her commentary on the current presidential election, some of her views on racism. She wanted to know which broadcast. We had this discussion where she questioned whether or not it was relevant that Michelle Alexander has a white parent, and I submitted then and maintained that absolutely it is important, and not just her, any other non-white person on the planet, if they have a white parent, that certainly is relevant information. Doesn't mean that they are no longer a victim, doesn't mean you shouldn't listen to what they have to say, but just that is something, you know, important to keep in mind. Anyway, the broadcast was the compensatory call-in for Saturday, April 2nd. Saturday, April 2nd, if anybody needs to go back in the archives, Puff specifically, if you wanted to go back and check it out again, it was the Saturday, April 2nd compensatory call-in. Speaking of compensatory call-in, I will remind folks, major adjustment coming. I had been saying for a while we were going to have to recalibrate how the compensatory call-in operated because we had a lot more people participating during that call-in, which is great. But the problem was coming that people weren't really getting as much of an opportunity to ask questions or to have dialogue during the call-in portion before we transition to workplace racism. And so to accommodate, I've said consistently and maintained I did not want to make this change, but, you know, everything that you do as a part of racism and counter-racism is not necessarily something that you personally like. So this is not something that I personally like for a variety of reasons, but hopefully this will be in the best interest of the broadcast and other victims of racism. Starting this Thursday, that would be June 2nd, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, we will have the Workplace Racism segment on Thursdays. It will be every Thursday. Normally, Workplace Racism was an hour, so I guess we'll start with an hour, 5 to 6, and we'll see if folks have more to share. This is not going to be it's supposed to be Workplace Racism, but I want to call in and talk about white people having sexual intercourse with non-white people or any other random things that pop up. I know it's on Thursday, so let's call and talk about Scandal and, you know, Empire was on last night. That is not what we're doing. We're going to be focused on what the topic is, workplace racism. So we'll start out with 60 minutes. If for some strange reason it ends up where we have more than 60 minutes worth of workplace racism, that is grand. We will hang out longer. But starting out, it'll be 60 minutes. So it'll be 8 p.m. Eastern to 9 p.m. Eastern. That would be 5 p.m. Pacific to 6 p.m. Pacific every Thursday, the Workplace Racism segment, now on Thursdays. And then the compensatory call-in, that will give more time. So if people want to call in to talk about observations, news clips, certainly if people still have workplace racism that they want to share during that segment, that is great. But that should allow for more time for people to share, discuss, ask questions, that sort of thing, during the compensatory call-in on Saturdays. But that'll be starting Thursday. Hopefully we'll have folks to tune in and participate. Alrighty. List of things I wanted to make sure I touched on that had accumulated over the month or past few weeks at least that I wanted to share my views on. We will make time if folks have commentary that they would like to share. Starting out, quick things. I'm kind of building as we go, like prioritizing on my list. So starting out, I'd said people have shared through the years all kinds of news clips, movies, just all kinds of items that they find that are relevant to racism, white supremacy, that they would like Gus to check out or what have you and give a thought on. I think folks, it seemed a good number of people were familiar with the film Zootopia that came out earlier this year. It's a Disney animation film. I think it came out in like February or March of this year. It got a good bit of attention because people said that it related to racism, white supremacy. I'm not going to talk about the film in detail. I can do this real quick. The gist of the film is basically that this city of all types of animals, that there is prejudice amongst the animals, and they don't have rabbits on the police force. So they say, well, we're going to have like an affirmative action program so that we get some rabbits on the police force. And so this rabbit, she joins the police force, and they still are discriminating against her. They make her like a parking attendant or something, you know, real low down in terms of power and authority. Anyway, as the film proceeds, and people commented about this film specifically, like there were articles in The Root where they were saying that this film specifically addresses white supremacy, and they used that term in the title of the report, and many others, they were like, wow, Disney made a film dealing with racism. This is, wow, that's so progressive, and, you know, can you believe Disney did this project? One of the listeners checked it out. They asked me to give my comment on it. I can just play this quick clip right here. It's less than 60 seconds. This is the thing that stood out most to me in this film, Zootopia. Quick 60-second clip. This is the assistant to the mayor. This is a sheep speaking about what she sees as the problem in the kingdom of Zootopia. Pay attention to the numbers that she shares when she gives her commentary. So this is the sound clip from Zootopia.
We're on the same team, Judy. Underestimated, underappreciated. Aren't you sick of it? Predators. They may be strong and loud, but prey outnumber predators 10-1. Think of it. 90% of the population united against a common enemy will be unstoppable.
Okay, so this is the assistant to the mayor, she, again, a sheep. She's talking to Judy, who is the rabbit who got promoted via the affirmative action program, first rabbit on the police force. What stood out to me, there are certain numbers that are significant to me within a context of white supremacy. That ratio, where the prey outnumber the predators 10-1, that the prey make up 90% of the animal population, the predators only constitute 10% of the animal population, that should be very, very significant for students, counter-racist students. I would say particularly students of Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, who talks about her theory of white genetic annihilation and individuals who classify themselves as white constituting a maximum of 10% of the global population, maybe less than that. That should be like, whoa, extremely significant. For me, what that symbolized, having the victims, 90% of the population, the majority of the folks on the planet, in this case, they're talking about the animals, saying, hey, the predators, they are in the minority. We should be actively working to permanently neutralize the predators. Now, within the context of this movie, everybody is, you know, getting along. The predator animals, they are not attacking anyone at this point. Everybody is getting along. But the position that the sheep that you heard talking in that clip, the position that she's taken is, hey, we are 90%. The predators, I think, eventually, at some point, they are going to attack us. That is their nature. That is their genetic makeup, is to attack us. They are predators. We need to be preemptive and go after them so that this never happens. We're in the vast majority anyway. She, incidentally, is the villain in the film. That is what stood out to me, symbolizing if non-white people, the majority on the planet, if melanated folks said, hey, the predators, racists, individuals classified as white, they constitute a maximum of 10% of the global population. We should unite. We should make it our business to neutralize them immediately. We too would be cast as the villains. Like, oh my gosh, they're racist. I can't believe that they've taken this position. It very much reminded me of people who say that, hey, the problem is white people. All of them, even the ones who say that they're cool and they're not being racist now. I've adopted a white child. I've adopted a non-white child. I have black friends and blah, blah, blah. I marched with Black Lives Matter. I voted for President Obama. Whatever. You are the problem. you are in the predator group on the planet in terms of terrorizing non-white people. But that is the thing that stuck out most to me with Zootopia. Again, as I said, they try to make it seem as though everybody in Zootopia is racist, prejudiced. It's not just one group mistreating another group. It's everybody is prejudiced or discriminatory against some of the other little critters, animals in the kingdom. Anywho, I will say again, reading is more important than watching television. I hope people didn't go to the movies to see Zootopia. I did not, or any other flicks. We, again, have way more problems, should be prioritizing our time much better in the system of racism, white supremacy. Speaking of reading, I'm not doing this to try to advertise or beg people to participate in the book study session. I'm really only doing this out of gargantuan respect that Harriet A. Washington has earned. Just reading her book, Medical Apartheid, is phenomenal. It is in my top 10, maybe even should be in my top 5, although that would be kind of tough to have to remove something that's in my top 5 to put that in there. But I mean, it's that good, and we've only read half of the book. We are exactly halfway through the book. We've done 6 study sessions. It's in the archives. You can feel free to go back and listen and catch up. Even if you don't listen, that's why I said I'm not really begging people to participate. We've had fantastic participation throughout so far. I hope it continues through the last half of the book. But even if you don't want to chime in, if you don't like listening to audiobooks and that sort of thing, this is a book you should have in your library. In fact, check, this is a book you should read, not just one that you babysit and say, oh yeah, I got that. I got a hardback copy. I got to sign it. No, this is a book that you should read, study, highlight, that you should know well, maybe even read with your whole family. You will learn a ton. It's such an important book. If you're a serious student of counter-racism, if you're serious about solving this problem, that is a book that you cannot avoid, ignore, miss, or make a lazy effort at read. I got through the first chapter and I just couldn't make the time, read that book. Anyway, one of the major themes in the early portion of the book is the grave robbing of Black people's remains and using them for further just whatever diabolical purposes racists come up with, whether they want to conduct experiments, whether they want to use them for their white medical students or anything else. You can even insert the delectable Negro. But whatever nefarious means they come up with, stealing the corpses and remains of Black bodies, a major theme that she talks about. So yesterday, I'm going through my Twitter timeline at Until Justice, just checking out what my Twitter folks, what they're tweeting about. Most of the people that I follow, they are generally sharing constructive information, things related to racism. So it's a non-white female, Black female, New Orleans native. I met her this past summer when we were doing all our study session on Gary Rivlin, Katrina after the flood. And I was reading 5 Days at Memorial by Sherry Fink, I believe is her name. I'm reading that book, Suspected Racist, White Female Author. My friend on Twitter, she had written a dissertation about Katrina literature and the way that white people talked about what happened in New Orleans during and after the devastation with Hurricane Katrina and the levee failure. And she gave me just tons of great information, shared, recommended other books to check out, the whole nine. So we stayed in contact on Twitter. I was checking out, and she had posted on her timeline how people, like now, 2016, were going and doing grave robbing in New Orleans. And I was like, do what? Where do you have, like, a link or something? And once again, she came through like a champion and hooked me up with about 7-8 different links. In fact, I don't even have to read anything. I can just give you the audio clip. Shout out to my friend on Twitter. I just try not to call out names in case people don't want to be identified, but I was super hooked up. So this is one of the links that she shared about what's happening in New Orleans. This is not 19th century 1600s. This is right now, 2016, New Orleans, Louisiana.
A person who identified herself as a witch to our coverage partners at the New Orleans Advocate is at the center of a criminal investigation. She's accused of taking human remains from a historic New Orleans cemetery and trying to sell them online. The 24-year-old has now skipped town, but spoke to Tanya Dahl by phone tonight.
Graves dating back to 1879 line this historic New Orleans cemetery. Originally, it was a place where the city's indigent population was laid to rest.
Whether it's in Holt with a very simple little decoration, whether it's in St. Louis number 2 where you have huge monuments, somebody went to some trouble to honor somebody's life.
Visitors can easily spot crumbled tombstones and sometimes, especially after the rain, human remains. Investigators say those remains caught the attention of Devon Marie Machuca, a.k.a. Ender Darling. The 24-year-old is accused of plucking human bones from graves and trying to sell them online, advertising her finds on social media sites like Facebook, saying she could be found at this address on South Solomon Street.
Court documents describe how a user with the name of Ender Darling on Facebook allegedly sent pictures to customers of remains found here at Holt Cemetery. In one case, they included 13 human bones and 3 teeth.
Court documents say some of Machuca's posts describe how the bones could be used in, quote, curse work or general spells. We reached out to the 24-year-old by phone, who told our coverage partners at the New Orleans Advocate that she's now hiding in Florida, fearful for her life because of backlash. She didn't confirm or deny the allegations she now faces with the Louisiana Department of Justice. But she did say she has family ties to Holt Cemetery.
I'm from New Orleans, too, and I live there, too. I have family members buried in that graveyard, too. So y'all can stop treating me like some tourist that just came out of nowhere, is what you can do.
Save Our Cemetery's president, Adam Stevenson, is appalled by the case.
The fact of the matter is they are human remains. And there are laws against theft of automobiles and everything else. And there are laws against removing human remains from a cemetery.
Neighbors like Amanda Bennett live by some of New Orleans' most treasured cemeteries. Keeping a closer eye on such sacred sites is paramount to her.
I think all the cemeteries could probably benefit from improved security. I don't know if the nature of the cemetery really makes it a bigger target or not. I'm sad to hear about it happening anywhere.
Tanya Dahl, Eyewitness News.
Now, according to court documents, a search warrant was executed at Machuca's Mid-City house, where investigators found a fish-type bowl with 11 human bones and 4 teeth. The state attorney general's office confirms it is investigating this case. And this story was developed by our partners at the New Orleans Advocate. And you can read more on the story at theneworleansadvocate.com.
Context of white supremacy. You can check. They have several reports in some of the local New Orleans outlets, the New Orleans Advocate and many others. In fact, you can do a search online, Bonghazi, one word, hashtag Bonghazi. And that will reference this story that they're talking about specifically, Ender's Darling, the suspected racist who was collecting human remains and using them in some sort of ritual, witchcraft practice. Again, the delectable Negro and the religion of white supremacy. I am sure that some of this grave robbing of black burial sites is not just about we want cadavers for our aspiring young scholars and medical students so that they can get a better understanding of human anatomy. I am sure that some of this is about the ritual of white supremacy. It would have to be. Logic would dictate that to me, just understanding what I do about racist man, racist woman, racist child, even some of our previous guests on the program. At any rate, medical apartheid, I would not have even been aware, had my radar tuned to that sort of thing, if we were not reading medical apartheid. And again, we're only halfway through the book. Moving forward, also had a listener in terms of just things I was supposed to comment on here or there somewhere during the broadcast. Ta-Nehisi Coates is writing the new comic book series, Black Panther. I don't know if folks have seen it or not. I think they've only done maybe 3 issues so far. It's pretty new. I know I've played audio segments about it on the program before. I have read the first issue. One of our listeners got me a copy, the first issue that came out. I had to reserve comment, number one, because I've only seen 1 issue. I'll have to check out 1 or 2 more before I can make comment. I will say, if people saw the cartoon series that came out, the animation series that came out a few years back, Black Panther, where it involves some of the Marvel superheroes, like Juggernaut and some of the other popular heroes are in it. But it's basically the same storyline. I think it's Wakandi, if I'm saying it correctly, is the name of this fictional place that's on the continent, in the continent. And they're following these black people, their kingdom, and, you know, what they're doing as part of the superhero team. It is, like I said, I have to reserve judgment. I will say, I mean, it's a comic book. Like, I'm not saying it to be silly or anything, but I mean, it is a comic book for people. If you read, like, Superman or Batman or any of the other comic books that they have, it's a comic book in every sense, in terms of the animation, the storyline, how it reads and all that. It is a for real comic book. Yeah, it's, I can't even give a full commentary on it. I said I'm going to have to reserve judgment. I read it a couple times because I was a little confused as to what was supposed to be happening. And then as I read the storyline, I was like, oh, yeah, this is just, it's based off the storyline on the anime, the cartoon that came out a few years back or what have you. And I think there was even a comic about this before that cartoon series that came out a few years ago. I know some of the people that were involved in the Boondocks were also involved when this anime series was on. I think they did like 10 episodes or what have you some years ago. But if anybody has seen that, I'd be interested on that commentary, particularly if you have been able to read more than one of the comics like I have. So I have kind of a smaller body of work to make an assessment of. But I did at least want to reference, if anybody has checked that out, if you have any thoughts on that. I'd be particularly curious if there are younger people, when I say younger, like people, teens, who have checked that out and have any views on that. Anywho, moving forward, I guess I was going to mention this as well. There was a report in the New York Times, like, earlier this month where he and his wife, black female, they bought residence in the New York area. They valued the property. They listed in the article at like a $2 million piece of property. They bought it and then they never moved in because they bought it under anonymity, right? Because he does have a certain amount of celebrity status. So he didn't want to be identified and what have you, to be harassed and have people, you know, doing all the crazy stuff people do. Anyway, the information was leaked, probably deliberately, probably an act of racism. And they got all this harassment. I think they even tracked down some of his children's, like, social media accounts and were sending stuff at them. And so they were just like, forget it. We're never going to live in this property. And I thought I might have had a moment of anti-blackness. We did Ta-Nehisi Coates' book, Between the World and Me, on the program before at the end of 2015, and it was not one of my favorite books. It is not going to be breaking into my top 10 favorite books, but he is a victim of racism, certainly, and I have referenced many of his articles before. I've read material that he's written, some of it that I think is very constructive, accurate analysis of the problem, white supremacy, but I wasn't as much a fan of that book. But when I read the article, I was not, I didn't have a lot of sympathy around it. And I said, oh, this might be anti-blackness on my part, because I didn't feel very sympathetic. I guess, number one, the first thing that came to mind is that there are tons of black people who are harassed and terrorized in their living area, and they do not have the resources, the ability to just say, oh, well, I'm just going to move. Or, much less, I can spend $2 million on a piece of property and then, because of harassment, just decide that I'm not going to stay there. Most of the victims of racism, particularly black people that I know, don't even have that option. They don't even have the ability to manage the situation in that sort of way. That was the first thing that kind of came to mind. Really, that was kind of the overriding thing. Like, it didn't seem like this was causing an inordinate amount of distress and discomfort. You can just, you know, sell the property, what have you, recoup your funds and keep it moving, get another property. But I did acknowledge and say, wow, this could just be anti-blackness, because that is messed up. Like they were saying, his children were being harassed on social media, and they went through all this effort to purchase the property with some anonymity and then had the information leaked. And I suspect that probably was an act of racism to divulge that information that was supposed to be kept private so people could, you know, do their thing and just be trifling and tacky and harass his family. Act of racism, victim of racism, but that is something I wanted to toss out. Could have been a moment where Gus was having some anti-blackness of my own. Moving forward, speaking of prominent black people having a difficult time, it just to me seems like there has been a lot of that. I mean, that is kind of standard under the system of racism, white supremacy, but over the past, I would say at least 2016 and maybe a little bit before that as well. It just seems like a lot of prominent black people, particularly black like elected officials, black people that are supposed to be in some position of authority, have been catching a really difficult time. Certainly Bill Cosby and that whole saga that, you know, is continuing. And again, I'm not saying that he is innocent of anything. I wasn't a big fan of him before all of this broke. He could have, you know, certainly done some of the things that he is accused of having done. But what's happening with him, Marilyn Mosby, the attorney down in Baltimore, Maryland, who brought charges against the officers in the Freddie Gray case. Thus far, the two officers that have went to trial, neither has been convicted. And it's just been a growing number of people saying, oh, my God, I can't believe this niggerous, you know, charged these officers. And, you know, what a disgrace. I think I played the audio clip this past weekend where they were basically saying that the chief rushed to judgment, just trying to quiet down the rioting and looting Negroes in Baltimore to keep them from burning up more CVSs and what have you. And she shouldn't have charged anybody to begin with. I think Commissioner Bratton in New York said the same thing. He did a radio program last week. He's not even in. I don't even know why he felt he had to comment on this. I guess since it relates to law enforcement, he felt he had to get in his two cents. But he weighed in saying the same thing, that, you know, these officers should have never been charged. I think two of the officers that were charged have filed a suit alleging defamation of character in the case, even though a lot of people have said that they don't think this suit is going to go anywhere, that it's just symbolic. But I've even seen reports where people are saying that they, you know, have suspicions or doubts if she will be reelected. I think she might be up for reelection sometime within the next year. They are doubtful if she will maintain her seat as prosecutor in Baltimore. Clarence Thomas, Justice Clarence Thomas, who seems like he catches flack all the time. They just had that decision last week where it was a black male in Georgia, where Clarence Thomas is from, incidentally, where he said he did not get a just trial because the prosecutors deliberately excluded black jurors, and they ruled in his favor. I think the ruling was 7-1 at the Supreme Court last week, where they decided that that was correct, that his rights to a just trial were violated, and that he's supposed to get a new trial. And he was facing the death penalty, by the way, this black male. And Justice Thomas, as I said, 7-1, Justice Thomas was the lone dissenting voice, and I mean, woof, they came out of the woodwork. Even the white people hopped in. Be like, no good Uncle Tom, I hate him, I can't be him. And they just went to town on Clarence, as usual. I mean, they do this every time, I feel like, where they have some sort of decision, particularly anything that deals with racism, the voting rights issue. It happened last year when they had the gay rights issue. Anything that comes out on those type of social issues, oh man, if he takes a dissenting view, they are coming. They act like it's nobody else on the court, like he's the most powerful person there, and they just go to town on Clarence Thomas. Again, victim of racism. It doesn't mean that I agree with Clarence Thomas. It doesn't mean that I like, quote unquote, Clarence Thomas. I'm just making an observation about what has been happening to prominent, more prominent black people, particularly black people that have in some position of power or authority. Even I was paying attention to Loretta Lynch, Attorney General Loretta Lynch, last week. It was announced that they were going to pursue the death penalty against Dylann Roof down in South Carolina, the young white terrorist who, coming up on a year, his terrorist assault at the Mother Emanuel AME Church in Charleston. I did not hear as much flack going at her. They were already pursuing the death penalty on the state level against Dylann Roof. I know that the reports that I saw, that they said that this was kind of unusual to have both federal and state prosecutions seeking the death penalty, that generally doesn't happen where somebody is facing the death penalty from both levels of government. But I suspect that there could be some commentary directed at her and her other actions. You know, people just having this black female in this position to begin with is enough of an offense. Tony Chaplin is the black male officer, interim chief of police in San Francisco. They just fired the former chief, sir, who's a white male in San Francisco, after they shot and killed a black female in San Francisco earlier this month. Jessica Williams was her name. She was unarmed. But they put in an interim black chief, Tony Chaplin. He's been catching it. They were supposed to have a community meeting about this shooting of Jessica Williams, and he canceled it. He said that they've been having these meetings every time that they shoot a Negro in San Francisco, or they have some sort of shooting or police misconduct, allegation of police misconduct. They have a community meeting, and generally close to the vicinity of where things happened, so that people can ask questions and get, you know, whatever information that they want about the case. And they said sometimes that the meetings have been tense and, you know, people have come to yell at the police that they're not pleased and they're unhappy. And he announced that they were not going to have a community meeting about the shooting of Jessica Williams, this black female who was shot and killed earlier this month, because they didn't think it was productive to have these meetings that people just come to shout and yell at enforcement officers, and they're not going to do it. And people were upset about that and going in on Mr. Chaplin, and they wrote several articles saying that they don't know if this is going to make any real difference, having this new enforcement officer, black chief of police in San Francisco, if this is going to really make any changes, because they've been having a lot of problems over the last year, all the racist text messages and all this other stuff coming out. I mean, it's just been tons of Africa Bambaataa. I don't even think we've talked too much about that, where he's facing allegations of sexual misconduct that, you know, he apparently is accused of doing these things some years ago against young children. Same thing I said with Bill Cosby. I don't know in terms of the truthfulness of these allegations. I don't know if this is going to go to trial, if this is something that's going to be adjudicated, but it just seems like lots and lots of black, particularly officials, not isolated, not solely black officials or black people that are in some prominent position, but lots of black people that are in higher positions of stature on the plantation, just seems like they are catching it. And I think that that is a part of 2016 and what is happening, the reconstruction of white supremacy. Really, if I was going to use Dr. Welsing's analogy, where she says Mr. Fuller's four stages of white supremacy: establishment, maintenance, expansion, refinement, that recycles, that we have been in the refinement stage, and it just recycles. It starts over. It goes back to establishment. I think this is what that looks like. In fact, you can even go back. We were talking about the Reconstruction period. Man, we should read something on that. We should read something else on that. I guess we read Ben Tillman and the Reconstruction of White Supremacy last year, but there's a lot of literature on the Reconstruction period. We should read some of that, because it is similar in that regard, where you had black elected officials. You had a lot of black congressmen and what have you, and state legislatures at that time. A lot of those folks were under attack, even in Ben Tillman, the Reconstruction of White Supremacy that we read last year. You had elected black officials being assassinated at that time, where whites were just done. We're tired of these, you know, uppity Negroes trying to tell us what to do and rule over us. The threat of Negro domination hangs over us like the sword of Damocles. We're tired of this, and we're ready to roll, and we're going to get rid of these Negroes. That was pretty much what happened in 1870s. It looks very similar in terms of what's happening now. I would, again, especially with regards to more prominent black figures being attacked, kind of something to pay attention to as we proceed. I'll also get in kind of quick, since I mentioned Tony Chaplin. That seems to be a major part of the racist strategy right now in terms of any police department that is facing any criticism or scrutiny around having shot and killed a Negro or anything, brutalized somebody, tased somebody. We'll fire the white person and we'll bring in a black person. This is worldwide. Toronto, where we've been talking about what happened with Andrew Locu and Jermaine Carby. They have a black police chief. I think he's been there for a while. They didn't fire anybody, but he's been there. Mark Saunders, the Ferguson situation that we've been talking about, where they just hired Delrish Moss, who's down in Florida. They brought him in. As I just said, Tony Chaplin, San Francisco. He is not the chief. He is the interim chief in San Francisco. But this just seems like a pattern to either fire. If you're going to fire, relocate, transfer the white person who's in that position, and then bring in a black person and say, hey, this is not about racism. We hear you niggers out in the street, Black Lives Matter, yes, and so now we will have a nigger in the office of chief of police, and now we won't have any more problems with racism. And it's almost like they walk off the stage when a white person makes this announcement. They walk off the stage snickering, right on, we've got this nigger in office, so, you know, the niggers should be happy now. And then they just continue doing whatever they're going to do. They know that this black person is not the person who is really in charge of the department. I would almost switch and play that clip from Crash, which terrible movie, but I do think that one section where they play, where they have a black police officer talking about his impotent position within the LAPD is brilliant. That's about the only accurate portion of that two-hour disgraceful piece of cinema. Reading is more important than watching television, but important thing that's happening right now worldwide. My only commentary on that would be to remember that it is white people to blame. I would encourage not wasting a whole lot of time fussing at these black people that are allegedly in charge. White people put them there, white people can remove them, and white people are still in charge, much like what we have observed with President Obama over the last almost 8 years. Moving forward, before I get to the clip on Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, and man, it's so important, and it's great because it's so far back, relatively speaking. It's before the Trump phenomenon was even in existence, right? This is before the piece that I'm going to play. It's before even the 2012 election when Obama was looking for his second term. But it is so relevant, in my opinion, to what is happening right now and Trump's potential run to the White House. But before I get to that, we've been on the program so long. It is wild just for me even reflecting, because I did not have any notion when all of this started that we would be broadcasting for this long. We came back to the air when we do our anniversary and everything. I said we've been back on the air for 7 years plus now. That is true. We came back on the air February 2009. The cows started in October 2007, although we were only on for 2 months, and then whites threw us off the air, which I predicted would happen if we were constructive. Back of the bus and I, we talked, and that was what I said. We will know we were at least kind of fumbling in the right direction if whites have a problem with us having this program on the air, which they did in a very short period of time. And in 2 months, we weren't even, it's not like we were broadcasting every day or multiple times a week. We only did one program a week. We had a 2-hour segment every Friday, once a week. And so, I mean, we only did about 10 programs. I don't even know if we did 10 programs. It might have been less than that. But in a very short amount of time, they were done with us at the University of Washington's radio program. So one of the first times that we had a guest on the program, it was late October of 2007, and the Black Student Union at the University of Washington. This is like student group. It's not all black students, because they did have white members at that time. I'm sure they still have white members now, but mostly black members. I'd say if I had to put a percentage on it from what I saw, I went to several, many, many meetings. So from my observation at that time, it was more than 80% black. We went to a meeting. They were having a bachelor's auction, and that was what it was called, the Black BSU, Black Student Union bachelor's auction. Man, just reflecting on that, I so wish that we had kept the audio or the recordings from the meeting. The gist of it, they were having this auction where they had black male members of the Black Student Union. And I think even if you were not a member of the Black Student Union, if you were just a black male student at the University of Washington or affiliate or whatever the case may be, you could volunteer, sign up, and basically you would go and people could bid on you. You go on stage and people could bid on you, and whatever money was raised in auctioning you off would go to the Black Student Union, and they would raise, it was like their fundraiser. They would raise, like, I don't know, $1,500 ballpark, something slightly lower than $2,000 is what they would raise at that time as part of their fundraiser, right? And I immediately saw this, just like, oh my God, the incorrectness of that. I could not believe that. And they said that they would solicit white fraternity and sorority members to come to the auction and bid, because they have money, right? So to come and bid on these black males. And I just thought, wow, like this is super incorrect. Like, there has got to be a better way to raise funds. So we talked about this. I think that was the first time that I think the members of the Black Student Union that we had on, that was the first time that we had guests on the cows. Like, the first couple times that we did programs, I don't think we talked at all. And then gradually, myself and Back of the Bus, we talked. And then they were the first guests that we had on the program in October of 2007 to talk about the bachelor's auction, the origin of this, is this incorrect, connections to slavery, the whole nine. During that broadcast, we got them to agree to have a meeting at during their monthly Black Student Union meeting. We got them to agree to discuss this. Maybe this is not correct. Maybe we can do something else to raise funds. So they agreed to have the meeting. It was the most it was the most crowded meeting I'd been to. It was about 100 people there, most of them Black. It was incredible. It's all I so wish, because there was recording. I so wish I had that recording, because it was so powerful on so many different levels. Two of the moments out of many things that were striking for me, two of the moments that will stick with me for a long time. One of the most profound. We brought two white people there, a white female and a white male, and they stood up at the beginning of the meeting and they said, "You should suspect me of being a white supremacist, but I, as a white man, I, as a white woman, I think this is incorrect doing an auction. This seems like something that greatly perpetuates white supremacy. It seems like something that white supremacists would love to see Black people auction each other off. And I think you all should maybe think about doing something else." I'm paraphrasing, but that was the gist of what both of these white people that we invited to the meeting said to start things off. So the meeting, this is like a 2-hour discussion, right, with a room full of like 100 people, most of them Black. Like, I think it was probably 90% of them Black. So this discussion goes for like 2 hours. There are tons of Black people. I would say out of the crowd that was there, I was stunned, because I was under the impression that like me and back of the bus and maybe 6 other people thought that there was something incorrect. I was stunned. They did a raise of hands with people who don't think we should do the auction. And it was like 35-40% of the people raised their hands. I'll say maybe 30 to 40. But I was stunned, because I had no idea that that many people thought that there was something wrong about this, which was a huge lesson for me that there generally might be quite a few other people who are in agreement, who see things as being incorrect about racism, white supremacy. Maybe they don't want to speak up. Maybe they don't even know. Maybe, you know, they've never said anything to you. But generally, there will be quite a few other people, more than you suspect, who will be in agreement with your stance on racism, white supremacy. That was one huge lesson for me. But anyway, I thought that there would be, most of the people would be like, you know, "Gus, shut up, get out of our meeting. This is great. You know, we're doing our auction and you can get the hell on." That was what I was expecting. So we continue with the dialogue, and so many people got up and were like, "I do not need no white person to come here and tell me that what we're doing is incorrect. I don't need any white." And I mean, it was like applause, like, "Yeah, that's right. I don't need no white person to come and tell me nothing." And this didn't just happen at the meeting. This went on for like 8 months. This meeting was in like October or early November of 2007. So I mean, like in April of 2008, I still had Black people who were at that meeting who would come up to me and be like, "Yeah, the discussion on the auction, that was great. It was such a great time. But I don't need no white person to come and tell me, a Black person. You could have just come and told me that there was something wrong with the auction, or, you know, anybody. I don't need no white person to come and tell me. It doesn't mean anything extra just because a white person said." That was one of the most profound things that happened. I obviously do not believe that. I had concluded a long time before that. And just the fact that 8 months after this, people were still coming up to insist that it doesn't mean anything. I don't need no white person to come tell me anything. It doesn't have more weight or more credibility or more validity just because a white person said it. I obviously do not think that that is true. I have seen nothing in my time on the planet to suggest that that is true. Everything about my existence, everything about my life under white supremacy tells me when a white person says something, it has a lot more weight than when a Black person says something. That is extremely unfortunate, but that is the logic of racism, white supremacy. Anyway, so that was one. Second, out of many profound, I mean, people got up and cried at this. It was incredible. Anyway, second most profound moment out of many, it was a Black male member, and he was an officer in the BSU, no less. So he's in front of the group. The discussion has been going on for maybe 90 minutes. And he says, "You know what? I heard you all," and he's looking
in my general direction, me and the other people that I'm sitting at, that basically we're in agreement. We think this is incorrect. You know, maybe we should do something else to raise funds. He's looking in my general direction and he says, you know, I've been hearing this discussion about the bachelor's auction for the past 2 weeks or so. And when I first heard concerns about it, I didn't understand. I didn't think anything was incorrect about it. I didn't see what the problem was. He said, after hearing all of this evening, I get it. I understand. I see what you're saying. And he says, what I want to know is, why did it take me so long to see that there was something wrong about the bachelor's auction? My jaw was on the ground. If I had had my druthers, that would have been when I on the program sometimes when I'm like, let's just pause. Let's not have any commentary. Let's just all sit with that for like, you know, a minute, maybe even longer, and just sit with that and maybe even answer his question, because I was not under the impression that he was asking that rhetorically. Like, I was seriously under the impression that he wanted an answer or at least commentary, feedback on why it took him so long. This is a college student, not a freshman, I don't believe. Why it took him weeks to connect the dots, as Dr. Welsing would say, that having an auction, auctioning off black males, that there's something incorrect about that related to slavery and white supremacy, and maybe a black student union shouldn't be doing that sort of thing. Extremely powerful, out of many that evening. Incredible. I so wish that we had the recording from that meeting. It was something I will not forget anytime soon, but I was we've been on the air for a long time, so there are many things I will just pause some days and be like, oh wow, I cannot believe that happened. Anywho, and I think there is even still audio. I think Mr. Williams has the audio of their visit on the cows when we had the actual members speaking. We had people call in as well to give their thoughts on the auction and whether they thought it was correct to do or incorrect to do. I think that audio does still exist. Again, I did not have enough regard, enough respect for the work that we were doing, because I really didn't think anybody was listening or cared what was going down on the cows at that time in 2007. So I really wasn't making an effort to save the recordings that we were doing. I didn't even know that was possible at the time. But Mr. Williams was looking out for us, and he did archive quite a bit of our material and rebroadcasted quite a bit of our material. Anyway, as I said, Dr. Welsing, Reconstruction of White Supremacy. In my view, this is even more important. I've been thinking about this segment like the whole year since her transition back in January, and particularly in connection to Donald Trump. I'm not sure if she included this in some of the talks that she gave, not the final Welsing Institute, but other places when she was on this program in November of 2015, and some of the other interviews that she gave on the Carl Nelson program and other shows. I'm not sure if she connected what was happening with Donald Trump as being a part of the reconstruction of white supremacy, but she was a guest on this program the summer of 2011. This is July 2011 specifically, her 10th time on the cows. And I had been talking to her privately off the air, and she said, the system of white supremacy, it recycles. I just laid that out before. Mr. Fuller's four stages of white supremacy, it recycles. Thankfully, when I talked to her privately, anything that I thought was really important, I tried to make a note and then ask her once we got her on the program so we could share it with listeners. And she did a great job. She took her time and broke down the whole concept. So this is like 10 minutes, but this is her dissecting that. I would encourage folks to just connect what she's saying here. And again, this is before the 2012 election. So this is before Donald Trump was even on the horizon for running for president in 2016. Connect this with Trump's campaign, as well as even what I said, at least my view. If other people, if you don't think this is happening, or if you don't think this is, you know, a deviation from what normally happens on the plantation in terms of these prominent black people being under attack, certainly you can speak up with that as well. But in my view, I would connect all of that with the reconstruction of white supremacy. And I think that's the term that she starts out with. But without further ado, this is Dr. Frances Cress Welsing. This is July 2011. Should be in the archives if you want to hear the entire segment and what she addressed there. July 2011, her 10th visit on the context of white supremacy, and she is addressing the reconstruction of white supremacy, how the system of white supremacy, it just recycles. The four stages of white supremacy as outlined by Mr. Fuller, they just start all over again. Context of white supremacy, we will get to Dr. Welsing's audio clip.
I spoke with you a couple weeks ago, and we were talking about Neely Fuller Jr., his four stages of white supremacy, establishment, maintenance, expansion, refinement, and you were saying that it is a cycle that repeats, and I had never heard that before. Could you share some of that with our listeners?
Yes. I think that a critical word is reconstruction. I mean, that's the word that has been used by historians and maybe misused. In other words, I look at starting with the emancipation of black people from formal enslavement. And slavery was a phase of the system of racism, white supremacy, enslavement of African people. So then the slaves were emancipated, and the slaves thought, well, the shackles are off, and now we're free, and we are going to be able to do whatever we need to do to maximally develop ourselves. And what the African people, emancipated African people, were then faced with was a whole system of laws that were called Jim Crow laws, we can call them white supremacy laws, were set up and put in place to block black people from really being able to move forward. And many black people, many black men were really put, you know, could be captured and put into on plantations to work, even though emancipation had come to an end. And so I said that was like the reconstruction of white supremacy. The reconstruction of white supremacy. Also, after, at the end of enslavement, there were black people in the South who became senators, and they had different positions in the government. And so then the laws were constructed, and those black people were knocked out of those so-called power political positions. So the next thing that happened was the civil rights era, where black people moved en masse, Dr. Martin Luther King and others, moved en masse to change the laws. And the laws were changed. But then the system of racism, white supremacy said, wait a minute, these black people are talking about black pride, black dignity, black power, black is beautiful. We cannot have them respecting themselves. If they really continue this respecting themselves, then we're going to have a difficult time maintaining the power equation of white over non-white. So we have to dismantle this black respect. And I maintain they did it psychologically through so-called music and entertainment. And whereas you had a group, a hip-hop group like Public Enemy, come out with an important album, Fear of the Black Planet, which they had based on my paper, The Crest Theory of Color Confrontation and Racism. They had put a political message on the rap. I maintain that the system of racism said, wait a minute, we cannot have black people made politically aware through the music that they listen to. So what we have to do is take charge of these musicians and pay them to put a trashy message, a message of trash and degradation of black people. Now, we're going to pay them millions of dollars so they will look important, and we will even have them giving monetary contributions to the Urban League and the NAACP and maybe even to politicians. But we will have them peddling trash the psychological destruction. Now, they are not politically sophisticated, so they won't understand why we are having them do this, but they'll be glad to get the money. And so we will have them purvey this trash. And so you end up with black people calling themselves niggers, gangsters, thugs, dogs, bow-wows, bitches, and hoes. So we became the only people on planet Earth that were willing to demean and degrade ourselves. Do you see? But again, that was what? That was a second Reconstruction following the Civil Rights Movement, when black people were moving in a positive direction about themselves. So then the next phase is a black man runs for president of the United States of America. Well, even though there was white support for his presidency, when he got into the White House and you have a black man with his black wife and his black children and his black mother-in-law in the White House, even the people who classify themselves as white, who call themselves liberals, begin to think, oh my God, what have we done? Because just the image of the black man being in the White House and being in charge begin to set off the anxiety of, if we lose power, if the power equation changes, and this in the parlance, in the symbolic parlance of white supremacy speech, you don't want to be caught behind the eight ball. Because if you're caught, that's language coming out of the game of billiards or pool. And all of these games are symbolically about racism, white supremacy, but in most instances not understood as such. But President Obama being in the White House makes the white mindset that is concerned subconsciously about white genetic survival begin to feel, wait a minute, we're being caught behind the eight ball, and that translates into white genetic annihilation. So then we have this massive attack. We can call this the third Reconstruction, meaning the reconstruction of racism, white supremacy. In other words, if the system moves from establishment, maintenance, expansion, refinement. Refinement is the emancipation of the slaves. Then refinement is changing the laws so it looks like equality. But each time you have that kind of gain, it has to be thrown back. Because the fundamental concern is white genetic survival by any means necessary. So you have a black man becomes president. He's intelligent, articulate, brilliant. Every single qualification that is needed to lead the nation, to lead the world. But then it hits subconsciously that this means white genetic annihilation, or symbolically, just because a black man is supposed to be in charge. And so we have to have the third Reconstruction, and that is the annihilation of his power in showing him all this talk about, you know, the budget and the debt and all of this, but the articulation that came out once he was elected, where you had spokespersons on the television saying, our goal objective is to make him fail and to see that he fails. And so now we have what I call the third Reconstruction of racism, white supremacy. And it's going on all across the world, so to speak, as I said early on, all across Europe. People who classify themselves as white are fighting against the tide of non-white people just moving into white areas, which makes them start thinking we're losing control and white genetic annihilation is imminent. And it's happening in this country, in this area of the world, simultaneously. And so, again, this is not for people, you know, people of color should not, well, we're going to hate white people. That's not the way you win a chess game. You don't win tennis hating your opponent. You don't win checkers hating your opponent. You have to understand the game that is on the table. And the game that is clearly on the table, local, nationally, globally, is racism, white supremacy, the struggle for white genetic survival on planet Earth by any means necessary. And we need to understand this, and we need to address it. And those black people who want to help, those people who classify themselves as white want to help, then they have to step out of the denial of racism. Don't come and talk, white people, don't come and talk to black people about how wonderful you are and how many non-white children you are adopting to make you not look like you're racist. No, what you need to do is to talk about, yes, we are engaged in the practice of racism, white supremacy, whether we call ourselves conservative or liberal or independent or green. Our fundamental concern is we belong to the white genetic survival political party. We have extreme in that, you know, people who go around shooting and killing black people, sneaking around in the dark or in the open, killing black people. And then we have people who pretend to be the friends of black people, but they don't want to talk about racism, white supremacy. So you have a complete, total spectrum, but the answer is, for people who classify themselves as white, who genuinely want to see justice on the planet, they will come out and talk about racism, white supremacy for what it really is. And instead of people yelling the minute a black person talks about racism, white supremacy, for the persons who classify themselves as white, yelling, "You're playing the race card." Well, listen, the whole deck is racism, white supremacy. And it's not a question of a non-white person playing the race card. It's people who classify themselves as white. See, that's very important. People who classify themselves as white. You classify yourself as white because this is where the power system structure that has been organized by people who classify themselves as white for white genetic survival.
Context of white supremacy. Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, if this is so-called Memorial Day, where we are supposed to recognize fallen soldiers, for sure, Dr. Francis Cress Welsing qualifies exemplary illustration of a counter-racist soldier who dedicated decades, a half century of her time on this planet to getting better information and equipping us with ammunition, information about the war of white supremacy being waged against black people, non-white people worldwide. Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. In that segment, I was reminded, and again, these were comments that were made like before the 2012 election. Mr. Neely Fuller Jr., you can get his literature at producejustice.com, producejustice.com. He was saying, this was 2012, he was saying that you have a lot of whites who are disgusted with the fact that President Obama has even been in the White House. That in their mind, that place needs to be fumigated. We need to tear it down and build a new seat of power for the presidency. We need to get a new name, a new title for that position, something else. We can, you know, figure up something other than president or commander-in-chief, get a whole new title, build a whole new structure since we've had that nigger there for the past 8 years. That whole place needs to be, you know, fumigated, sterilized. He had said this then, in my view,
having Donald Trump there, that could symbolically be that process of this office. The presidency of the United States has been so besmirched by this nigger being there that, you know, whatever, you know, just anybody can be there now. Joe the plumber, Donald Trump, anybody. Just be there now. I mean, it's worthless now having that nigger sit in the seat. I don't want to sit in that seat after the nigger's been there. That has come to my mind frequently with all of this. And again, why I'm very confident I'm getting close. President-elect Donald Trump, I'm growing increasingly confident Dr. Welsing will be proven extremely accurate once November gets here. But we have a long way to go. Anything could happen between now and then. One other quick note I wanted to get in. When I think at the beginning of the program, before we started today's broadcast, I played the segment where Mr. Fuller was talking about how racists, they just view black people as gorillas, monkeys, apes. And that if they see a black person in a fancy car, what have you, it's just, you know, monkey in a car. I think there was a big controversy. I think we are competing today with a big basketball game. Dr. Welsing was talking about ball games in the clip and that they all symbolically relate to white supremacy. I think there was a minor hubbub last week where Steve Adams, he's accepted as white. You have to ask some white people about that. But he's from the area of the world known as New Zealand. He referred to some of the non-white black players on the opposing team as little monkeys. He said those little monkeys are so fast. And some people heard that were like, whoa, that might be racist. Wait a minute. And they had dialogue about it. I think I shared one of a great article that was talking about this on my Twitter page earlier. But same thing, worldwide perception of non-white people, not men, not women, just animals. Little monkeys, little gorillas. Whites are outraged about the gorilla that just got shot, I think because a child got in the cage or what have you. They've been screaming and whimpering about that over the past few days. Before I get to some of the folks, if you all have commentary on anything that has come up over the past 60 minutes or so that we have been on, I feel like we touched on a variety of different subjects over the hour. The situation in Idaho where the black teenage disabled student was terrorized, sodomized, raped by this gang of white racist thugs in Idaho. There continues to be a lot of commentary around that, which is great. I hope that more people are talking about this. I, you know, am looking forward to hearing what Dr. Curry has to say about this, if he writes anything or if he does any quick audio recordings about this segment. There was a post in the Washington Post today. There was an article. I'm actually going to read the whole article because it's pretty fascinating. I might slip in a comment here or there, but I would just remind, because Dr. Welsing did touch on this in her commentary that I just played, where she talked about white people who, again, I'm not racist. I've adopted, you know, 8-12 of these little nigger children. What are you talking about? I'm not racist. Here, look, see, you have family portrait and everything. That does not disqualify you from the race soldier list. In my opinion, it just moves you higher up on the list of race terrorists. But the Post, the Washington Post article, A Community on Edge, Town Torn Apart by Sexual Assault Accusations Against Football Players. And this is, again, why I say metaphors. The town is not torn apart. I mean, you know, let's not be melodramatic or anything. There's one victim here. That teenager and I would say you have one direct victim and then you have secondary victims, the other black people who witnessed this, this other black person, his adoptive siblings and what have you, the other black residents in the town. It seems that there are not that many black people there, but those would be the victims. Everybody else there that's white, you're not a victim. And it doesn't seem, I'm sure these people are not crying and whimpering and struggling, wondering where their next meal is going to come from as a result of this, or hunkering down, they're going to lose their jobs. I am sure that that is not happening. In my opinion, this is just another way that racism, white supremacy is practiced, where they try to make it seem like once a white person or group of white people are indicted or suspected of practicing white supremacy, where it's, oh my gosh, we're reeling. This is a bombshell. It's kind of, they employ all of these metaphor words at the end of the day to obfuscate and just add confusion so that we're not being as clear and accurate as possible about what's going on. But let's read the report. This is written by Rob Kuznia, K-U-Z-N-I-A. This was posted today. Dietrich, Idaho. The first child they adopted was a 2-year-old from the Marshall Islands who had rotten teeth and a large abscess covering the side of his face. At the time, the family of Tim and Shelley McDaniel was still passably conventional in this no stoplight town of 330, surrounded by high desert dotted with sagebrush and cattle. But since the first adoption in 2000, the couple have brought into their fold 19 more castaway kids from all over the country, most from troubled families and half of them black. The McDaniels now provide their town in Idaho's conservative Mormon country with the entirety of its black population save one mixed-race child from another family, insert cowbell. It is a town in turmoil, thrust into the national headlines by a tale of racially charged violence and negligence graphically detailed in a $10 million lawsuit the McDaniels filed last week against the 230-student school district. The suit claims that three players on the high school football team sexually assaulted a mentally disabled teammate, a son of the McDaniels, with a coat hanger which they kicked deep into his rectum. The three alleged assailants are white. The McDaniels' son is black. The McDaniels sought legal help soon after the alleged October 22nd assault, which the lawsuit says followed months of escalating race-based bullying that coaches and administrators allegedly ignored. I needed to know how to keep him safe, Shelley McDaniel said of her son, who was a senior, and we were just shunned. The alleged assault and the lawsuit's contentions have torn apart the once tight-knit community, revealing the challenges of raising an unconventional family in a rural small town and sparking the resentment of people who feel unfairly branded as racists. It's a community on edge, said Lincoln County Sheriff Kevin Ellis. I think the way to put it is everybody feels targeted. And I'm just going to stop right there. There's some other things I could have pointed out, but just that right there, again, the metaphors and what have you, on edge of what? Are you about to fall off a cliff? What are you talking about? Everybody feels targeted? Do you have a bullseye on your chest? Is anyone shooting at you? Is anyone coming after you to stick a hanger in your rectum? What are you talking about? Just because there are allegations, and it seems evidence to support that there was racist conduct being practiced, why would everybody in the town feel targeted? If I didn't have anything to do with this, if I'm not a student at the school, even if I am a student at the school, if I didn't have anything to do with this, why would I feel targeted? Is someone coming there because of these allegations? Is someone coming there to round up all of the racists and put them in jail? I haven't heard anything like that. I've only heard three people being charged. I haven't heard anything happen to anybody else in the town. Nobody else, to my knowledge, has been criminally charged. What's the problem? I don't understand. Again, in my view, they do this sort of thing consistently where it is, we white people, we are the victims. We have been targeted. We have been torn asunder. Our lives are falling apart. Oh, woe is us. Moving forward, the tormentors, allegedly led by football star John R.K. Howard, a transplant from Texas with ties to a prominent Dietrich family, forced the victim to recite the words to a racist song, called him racist names, and in full view of coaches, physically fought him as part of a toughening up program until he fell down unconscious, the lawsuit claims. The players were expelled in November and criminally charged in March. Howard and an alleged accomplice, 17-year-old Tanner Ward, have been charged as adults with felony sexual assault for forcible penetration with a foreign object. Ward was bound for trial at a preliminary hearing in April. Howard is due in court June 10. A third defendant, 16, will be tried in juvenile court. No one has entered a plea yet. They're 15, 16, 17-year-old boys who are doing what boys do, said Hubert Shaw, who owns the town's feedlot and whose daughter-in-law is Howard's aunt. Now, even that right there is astounding for the allegations in this case. I don't know about you all. Having been a boy myself, I don't ever remember pursuing someone to ram a hanger or anything else up their rectum. That is not what boys did when I was coming up, but maybe I was, you know, I just missed out on what boys do. Moving forward, the McDaniel family began as a Brady Bunch unit, Tim and Shelley and their five biological children from previous marriages. They moved here from Boise, Idaho, 2 decades ago as newlyweds. Tim, tired of selling cars, decided to make use of his education degree and accepted a job teaching science at Dietrich High School. 15 years ago, the McDaniels started adopting children. The house felt so empty to Shelley when her own children were off with her ex-husband. I told her to start saving up, laughed Tim. Adopting kids is expensive. Tim, 60, and Shelley, 51, now have 25 children in total. To accommodate the outsized brood, I'm going to even start right there, stop right there. The term brood, B-R-O-O-D, is defined a family of young animals. A family of young animals. Now, the lower definition informally, all of the children in a family, but that's the lower definition. The first definition you will see with brood, a family of young animals. I think that is important since most of the children that they have been abducted, adopted, and are not white, black specifically. Extremely important use of language. Moving forward. To accommodate the outsized brood, they purchased a fitting building, the town's former elementary school, right across the street from Dietrich High, now a K-12 school. They remodeled it into a high-ceilinged homestead that has housed as many as 33 people. Right now, 9 of the children live at home. Outside, the family keeps 8 goats, 100 chickens, 12 dogs, and 5 turkeys. Baskets of fresh eggs sit in the former cafeteria. The McDaniels get state assistance for some of the kids they adopt. The amount depends on the child and the circumstances, but caps out at $400 a month. 3 of the children are subsidized by the state of Texas for that amount. The family didn't set out to become so teeming. After adopting several children with severe needs, the couple developed a good reputation with adoption agencies, they said, and people began seeking them out. They will take kids no other family will take, said Marty Weiser, executive director of SNAPS, an adoption advocacy organization in Idaho. A lot of people might assume they are doing it to make tons of money off each child, but not in that family. I think it just began with a few children, and they just have big hearts and take them in. That is how their first adoptee led to 2. When the mother of Ladre, a Marshallese boy, came to Idaho to drop the toddler off, she was 7 months pregnant. She asked the couple to take her unborn child as well. Five weeks later, Nalani joined the family. Now 18 and 15, both still live at the house. The family adopted their last pair of siblings 8 years ago, a 9-year-old boy and an 8-year-old girl who was out of control, punching herself, banging her head, hiding beneath tables at school. Another parent in Dietrich had adopted the children but was struggling and sought help from the school. So Tim McDaniel offered to take the children in for a while. Among the 16 kids adopted in the years between those bookends is the son allegedly assaulted in the locker room last fall. The Washington Post does not name victims in sexual assault cases. Exposed to drugs and alcohol in utero and diagnosed with disorganized schizophrenia, he struggles to carry out tasks that involve a sequence. When writing the first sentence of an essay, for instance, he may forget the point of the project. He carries this huge backpack full of all his books so he can be sure to have the one he needs, says Shelley McDaniel, herself adopted and raised in Boise. As a lineman with the football team, the team could seldom avoid jumping offside. The quarterback's play calls confounded him. Shelley says she first learned of the bullying in August through another son, 17-year-old Rahsaan, the team's manager. He told her some of the players would hump the backsides of him and his brother and other boys. Then her son came home in October with his underwear torn by a wedgie that he said his teammates had given him in the locker room. Incensed, McDaniel said she marched across the street the next day to confront the principal, Stephanie Shaw. McDaniel said Shaw instructed her to call the coach, Michael Torgerson. Shaw could not be reached for comment. Ben Hardcastle, the superintendent, declined to comment, citing the ongoing litigation. The three are among the defendants named in the lawsuit. When Shelley asked Rahsaan if he had been targeted as well, he told her about the alleged hanger assault on his brother. The couple took their son to the emergency room for treatment, and hospital staff reported the alleged sexual assault to the police. They ought to fire them all. The town of Dietrich was founded in 1909 along a railway whose cargo trains still announce their presence with a blast of the horn while disappearing into the desert expanse. Ernest Hemingway used to hunt pheasant here, and townsfolk have a photo to prove it. Back then, most of the inhabitants were homesteaders or rail workers. Now many of the residents either work in neighboring communities or for one of the two largest employers in town, the school district and the cattle feedlot owned by Hubert Shaw. His son, A.C., is much beloved as one of the winningest girls' basketball coaches in the state. A.C. Shaw caught a rare bovine disease that nearly killed him and left him wheelchair-bound. But he still coaches, as an ESPN segment on him noted last year, even though he can't walk and can barely talk. A.C. and his wife, Jalen, took Howard in last year. He had moved due to his inability to keep out of trouble in Texas, according to the lawsuit. He has since moved back to Texas, where his mother declined an interview request. Hubert Shaw said he didn't know Howard well. I would guarantee that those boys had no criminal intent to do anything or any harm to anyone, Shaw said. Boys are boys, and sometimes they get carried away. Have you ever been popped on the butt with a towel when you was in sports? But I know all the coaches, he said, and they are high integrity people, and they are not going to let anything happen. The town's mayor, Don Hyken, said sports are everything in Dietrich to an unhealthy extent. My son and daughter went to school here in the late 80s. He said neither wanted to take sports. Well, the kids ridiculed them. My son went out for football one year because he got tired of being teased. Hyken does not sugarcoat his opinion on the matter. I think they ought to fire them all, he said, referring to the long list of defendants in the civil case. When this happened, everybody just swept it under the rug. These two boys were the top players on the football team. The coaches didn't want to rock the boat. They were having such a good season. But Hyken also said the entire town has been besmirched for the alleged actions of outsiders. Ward is from the nearby town of Richfield. Hyken has gotten a few blistering emails from around the country. Something to the effect of, Dietrich looks like great scenery, but you guys are a bunch of, he said, his voice trailing off. Critics, I guess you'd call them, that were appalled about this whole thing. Well, I was appalled myself. The McDaniels, Mormons who worship at the town's meeting house, said the local bishop has reached out to offer advice on training and support for their son, who just graduated from high school. The church asked the people here to love everyone, not to take sides, and to say less rather than more, Shelley McDaniel said. This is consistent with their stand on being kind to everyone. Now, I would even pause right there. Number one, the history of the Mormon religion. I have said consistently through this program, the religion of white supremacy. They have their own undeniable history of white supremacy within the Mormon church that we have talked about on this program before. That would be one. Number two, just that paragraph alone, to not take sides and to love everyone. The next time that there's any allegation, you can think of the Jameis Winston case. In fact, any case where it is a white woman, where there's an allegation that there's sexual abuse, she's been mistreated, listen to see if anyone says, hey, let's not take sides here. We want to love everyone, treat everyone. Listen, if you hear that pop out at any point with the Bill Cosby litigation, hey, I don't want to take sides with the accusers. I just want to love everybody, love on Bill Cosby too. Let's just love everybody and not take sides. See if you hear that sort of malarkey at any time where it is the victim, the accuser, is a white person, particularly a white female, and see if you hear that sort of rhetoric. Moving forward. Ellis, the sheriff, is a family friend. The couple has called on to back them up on discipline, they said. But the McDaniels are looking to move. They had considered it a few years ago when the State Board of Education investigated Tim McDaniel after some students and parents objected to him using the word vagina when teaching reproductive biology. But the dispute made national headlines. The investigation was dropped, and the family decided to stay put. Now the McDaniels say the town feels hostile. At the Eagle's Nest, the Lone Bar and Restaurant, barkeep and waitress Felicia Royalson said she doesn't understand why the McDaniel family stays. Me being a parent, I'd probably do everything in my power to get the F out of town, she said. I wouldn't want to be here. Amid the bitterness and confusion brought by the lawsuit, at one point all students were evacuated from the school when a McDaniel's daughter came to visit a former teacher, her father, without stopping by the office. Royalson is taken aback by how the town can look like all is in order. Now, even I had to pause and reread that section a few times when they said that they had to they evacuated the school just because a female came to visit a former teacher, her father, and didn't stop by the office, and that was cause to evacuate the entire school. When you have had allegations of racism, sexual misconduct, rape, terrorism, all of this stuff that had been going on, I don't remember them saying that a school was evacuated or they took those type of extreme measures, but just a visit, we got to evacuate the school. Children's safety is top priority. In my opinion, that once again, the refrain, black lives do not matter. Anything is more valuable. A squirrel, football season, television program, basketball, anything is more valuable than a black person's life, even a disabled student, a disabled child. Continuing, amid the bitterness and confusion brought by the lawsuit, at one point, all students were evacuated. Oh, I read that. Okay. I was on my front porch drinking my coffee, and I thought, this is so amazing how there are kids playing, people mowing lawns, she said. Shoot, there was a boy walking a sheep down the street. You know, everything back to normal. But she doesn't believe it's really over. I think the storm's just begun, she said. And that's the report. Again, you can read this. This was published the Washington Post. A community on edge. Town torn apart by sexual assault accusations against football players. Washington Post was posted today. And even the last sentence greatly contradicts, in my view, what the title of the article is, because she's saying that everything is cool. They're walking sheep down the street again and chilling. Everybody is just going about business as usual. It doesn't sound like the town is torn apart. How would you be, you know, walking your pet sheep down the street and doing, you know, business as usual if the town is torn asunder and everyone feels targeted? I would have my sheep in the barn and be chilling behind closed doors if things were really that out of control. The terrorism knows no bounds. I can only assert again, in the words of Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, when you play around with sex, the joke is on the offspring. I would definitely encourage folks to keep an eye on how all of this evolves over the coming months. This could even be something that spans years, depending on the pace of the prosecution and if there end up being any indictments, not just the civil suit, but if there end up being any indictments of any of the school administrators or the coaching staff or anything else, just to keep an eye on how all of this progresses. Extremely important. And this is another one. If you have children, I would definitely share this with your children, just in terms of being alert for the type of things that can happen. I think they said the reports that we played last week how they tricked him before they abused him in some instances by saying, oh, come here and give us a hug. And then they would go and terrorize him once he lowered his guard, lowered his suspicion, thinking, oh, they're my friends. They just want to give me a hug and show me a little love. And then, bam, they would go to work sodomizing him and everything else to kind of use this as an example that we frequently are tricked by racists who can make it seem that they're just trying to be nice, that they're just trying to be friendly. And that's not the case at all. That happens on a regular basis, unfortunately, under the system of white terrorism, just not understanding what we're dealing with. All righty. With that, I will pause, give time if folks have any commentary that they would like to share. The number to dial is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Again, I feel like we touched on a variety of things over the past 90 minutes or so. But if you have commentary on any of the things that we have touched on thus far or anything else stood out in particular, feel free to chime in. I will... I will just open the lines up for the folks who dialed in. So we'll just do it that way so that everybody can chime in. If you're listening and you have something that you want to add, just raise a hand and I'll add you to the line. But all the folks who dialed in thus far who have a hand up, you should be with us. Feel free to add any commentary that you would like. Once again, I will prompt if you put your hand up and I'm announcing that I'm going to the line. If you know that you're in a noisy environment, if you're talking to other people, if you have the television on or whatever other background issues that you have, just mute your line. If you know that that is the case, if you're putting your hand up, I assume that you want to comment. If you're just listening, then just don't raise your hand. You can wait until later if you really want to comment or until you are in a quiet environment, and then you can raise your hand. But if you put your hand up and you don't want to talk, or you put your hand up and you know you're in a loud environment, it just disrupts the quality of the broadcast for me to have to then go and try and mute the line and all that if you're talking to other people or you have the TV on in the background or whatever else is going. Thank you kindly. Folks who dialed in with the hand up, did you have commentary?
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Caller from the 712. Hello to everybody on the line. And I just want to make some comments about what you went over today. I showed to Dr. Wilson and all of the soldiers. The sexual deviance is present in childhood and children who classify themselves as white, and we need to be aware of that, and we need to have our children be aware of that. Even if they're not doing anything most extreme, as these young people did, they're capable of it. With the people that adopted all of those children, I feel like they could have, you know, maybe gave the parents the money to raise them. Maybe their parents gave them up to the human services. I don't know. But the indigenous people of the continent, they have guidelines about their children being adopted by people who classify themselves as white. And they evacuated the school. What was that about? Because somebody came there? I don't know. They forgot to sign in. I won't forget to sign in from now on. And the last couple things, with at the end, walking the sheep down the street, and we're talking about sexual deviance, you know, with young people. So that's a connection right there. And I think there was a reference to somebody having a bovine disease. I don't know how you would get something like that, but it could be from sexual deviance, and we shouldn't put anything, I don't think anything is beyond what we're dealing with here, with this group of people here, and we just need to be more aware. And thank you so much. I can't mute my line, but thank you. I'll be quiet.
Right on. Great point about the bovine disease. I had exact same thought. You were on the same wavelength there for sure. Other folks who have commentary, feel free.
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I have a contrasting story, but yet it's very similar to the incident that took place in, what was that, North Dakota or South Dakota with the rape
Idaho.
Issue?
Idaho.
Idaho, I'm sorry. These are Dakota, all right. Idaho. Yes, I was a part of a staff, coaching staff, that was brought in as a result of a quote-unquote mentally disturbed young black female who was raped in a bathroom at a high school where I coached at before. And the state attorney, who is the top prosecutor, of course, in Miami-Dade County, basically, at first they arrested the football player. The full story is what she was underage and she was having sexual encounters in the school, well as in the immediate area around the school, the quote-unquote community also. But of course, you know, when it's dealing directly with the school, they took action. The player who it was narrowed into was a quote-unquote star football player. Basically, they had not done anything immediately, and he was allowed to play in the state title game under the OK by, I don't know if you remember, Rudy Crew, who was, before he became the superintendent of Dade County Public Schools, he was the superintendent of the public school system in New York. Non-white black male. And in turn, he was out of play, but some people can see that it was going to be more than that. Anyway, making results, they ended up getting rid of the entire coaching staff, moving them from coaching. They actually displaced some of the administrative staff of that high school. The principal no longer was there either. The football player who was a part of the team, he got arrested, but ultimately he didn't get prosecuted. Ultimately what took place was I think he was given some level of probation or something like that to a degree, but he never did really materialize to the college level. Because of the issue followed him, you know, they had this thing, quote unquote, on the recruiting level about character, and that played a part in his demise as far as being recruitable is concerned. But it's a lot different than what took place. What sounds like is not going to take place anyway in Idaho, and in turn, our staff was moved back into that particular high school as a result of and this story actually made national news back in 2007 or 2008. about this particular case that took place. Like I said, also with a quote-unquote another child who was emotionally disabled, was taken advantage of. That's the first thing. Other than that, I remember you were actually giving some history of the program itself. And every last one of those particular programs that you mentioned, I can remember vividly every last one of them. So I must have been listening to your program for a very long time, because I can recall every last one of those programs you gave as far as an example. And yes, they all of them were very instrumental and insightful. I think the key to the context of white supremacy as a program, I don't know, the first thing that comes to my mind is integrity, as far as that concerned. As a host, you have been very diligent on keeping down the content level of arguing and any unnecessary debating that I see take place on a lot of people's programs. Where it ends up being a whole lot of cuffing and you know, and cutting the food like sometimes we can do when there's no discipline involved in a program itself. And I think that's what keeps me, anyway, that's what keeps me from tuning into it. And it stays pretty much on point when it comes to logical counter-racist practices and thoughts. It stays pretty much in line with it. That to me far extends any other program that I've listened to, because I mean, at this stage in life with me, if it's something that doesn't really give me anything in that line of some kind of counter-racist understanding, I'm going to turn it off. If I'm watching television, I'm going to change the channel or cut it off, you know. And also, I'm very impatient with something like that. So this program keeps my attention. I put it that way. It keeps my attention because it stays within that line of something constructive to say. Even if it's something that everybody doesn't agree on, it still is done in a constructive manner. And it just goes to show you of the potential of counter-racist logic and codification and understanding, and how successful it can be whenever a significant number of non-white black people endorse that into their individual lives. Thank you for listening.
Sure, minimizing conflict with other victims, very important aspect of dealing with counter-racism, for sure.
One more thing, Gus. You remember the program where all of a sudden one of the callers started a conversation about hitting non-white black females, and it kind of like went off on a tangent in that direction. And how that was able to be corrected and straightened out. I thought that was a good example of how things can go negative and then you know, get straightened out. And so that was another good example of how things can, you know, possibly go wrong, but they could turn back in a constructive way when things are being codified. Yeah.
For sure. Definitely remember that one as well. How could we forget? other folks that we have not heard from, if you all had commentary, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening. Thomas Smith, New York. Yes, the second with firefighter just said, I think most importantly that there's a level of professionalism to your show as opposed to a lot of other blog shows that I listen to. And I listen to quite a few different, you know, to get other perspectives and point of views. And is a, you know, a level of professionalism to your show, the way it's produced. You can see that you put the time and effort into it. It's punctual. You know, some people start 2 hours late. So I mean, it's just I think the firefighter said, integrity is very good, and you should be commended for the job you do, Gus. I was listening to some of the things you were talking about before. I wasn't as aware of that whole story. I guess I kind of just heard they stuck the finger in the butt, and I didn't really, that one didn't catch my eyes as much as some other stories in the paper might have. But, wow, a white family. I mean, it's like, as that was freaking down, I was like, oh, this is explaining it all. You know, I was wondering where was the level of outrage, you know, but, yeah, it's a white family. And I think they just want to move away from it, because now that their black kid has gotten some white boys in trouble, they're probably, the code is kicking in that they have to, probably being shunned throughout the city, and they have to leave now and go, probably they'll go to Utah or some other Mormon camp. I wanted to say earlier, I guess, because Allen Iverson, he made the Hall of Fame, the great Allen Iverson, and they played the 30 for 30 with Allen Iverson, so I decided to watch it again, and this wasn't the Iverson documentary, this was the ESPN 30 for 30. But kind of rehashing some of those things. And it was quite interesting that right after that went off, and this was on MSG channel, Madison Square Garden channel in New York. Right after that went off, they played the whole series on all the athletes that went broke. So it was sort of like, I think it was sort of just to put him out there twice. I just wanted to say that... like I said, I agree with that story. As far as Donald Trump goes, I think that, I remember way back when we were reading Tillman, and I kind of hinted that, man, this is sounding a lot like what Trump was doing, and now he's going up against the Mexicans, and it's been quite interesting watching how they have formed against him, and they're fighting with the police, and still not treated the same way as we are, but I'm pretty much seeing the same consequences. This is just, white people putting it out there just so they can, when they come out with the indictment, this is just all the images they're going to show. I can see that happening pretty soon, especially as this whole thing progresses and, huge states with a lot of Mexicans, Oklahoma and Arizona and, California, of course, and Nevada, it might be other states. So just serious. I can see a lot of attempted riots at the behest of these Mexicans, and I can just see how the whites are foiling it with it. And I expect to see the same thing that I see when they deal with us. I just can't wait to see it happen. other than that, I'll mute my line for now. A lot of the stories you said, I think that your perspective, I agree with it a lot the same way. The medical apartheid book, I find it funny that, and I probably wouldn't have associated these two things together. But my stepfather, he's very ill, and he's been going to dialysis for some time. And, he has a lot of things wrong with him. So recently it's been decided that he would have to go to a nursing home. My mother's no longer able to care for him. He's no longer able to walk. And she had a back surgery not too long ago. She's not the best of stability herself. But either way, they live in Jersey City, New Jersey. And all their medical services get done in pretty much much more white city called Bayonne, New Jersey. And I just felt it was very strange that, the service that she would have needed to keep him from going to the nursing home would have been for them to provide the ambulance service to come upstairs and, help him outside for his dialysis treatment, but it doesn't. They don't provide that in Jersey City, even though they provide it in Bayonne. And I just felt like, you know, as many, it's much more blacks on dialysis than whites by the percentage. And here's a city which has a lot more blacks in it, you know, than the average city in New Jersey. You probably have to go to Newark to find anything close to Jersey City, maybe Patterson. But they don't provide that service for that city. It's just very strange to me. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Other folks, anybody that had a hand up that we have not heard from to have commentary?
Hey, Gus, if time permits later, can I make a comment about the Black Panther?
Oh, for sure, for sure, for sure. Anybody who had a hand up that we have not heard from have commentary they wanted to make sure they got in?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Considering, you know, all the problems that racism has to do in the sports arena with children and adults, I think sports is really detrimental and very unnecessary as far as black people are concerned. I know a lot of people say, oh, well, so-and-so, they make the pros, they're making X amount of dollars, but only to have their bodies fall apart when they get in their 40s and 50s and 60s, and a lot of times they're broke because they have to support other family members that are very poor. I know that kids get treated badly in the classroom as well, but it seems like during sports time, that's when it's like almost like anything goes, and that's when there's a lot of terrible racist behavior. I think black people just need to stick to education. I mean, if we want to build up our communities or start businesses and everything, I think education is the way to go as opposed to sports. I've never been interested in sports. I never allowed my kids to be in sports. I knew some black women that allowed their sons to be in sports and had problems with white coaches and white players and all that. And I would not have allowed my children to be in any kind of sporting activities. So that's my take on that. And also, I want to ask you a question. What's the difference between all white people are racist and a suspected racist?
I use the term suspected racist for two reasons. Number one, I'll use it if it's an individual, if I'm not sure if they are accepted, classified as white, if it's a individual, if they have a white parent and a non-white parent, but they are pale enough, melanin deficient enough that it looks like maybe they can be accepted as a white person, but I'm not entirely sure. Or if I, you know, am not able to ask them directly, or if they don't answer the question, I use the term suspected racist there. I also will use it even if I am sure that the person is white, just because my code is to not name call anybody, even white people. So I make it my business as in terms of how I do business of counter racism to not just go out and call white people racist. What I've seen that can have a detrimental impact on how you go about doing counter racism, because people, non-white people, if they just hear you saying, oh, well, this white person's racist, that white person's racist, blah, 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 if you're just doing it in that manner, it devalues the term. That's what I've seen, where they just say, oh, well, you just think every white person is racist and, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. Or you are racist because you're doing that, and because you can't prove it. If the white person says, I'm not a racist, I've seen where non-white people, victims of racism, have got in trouble for that, where they've said, you are defaming me, you're calling me a racist, you're committing libel, I'm not a racist, you don't have any evidence. There's no way that victims of racism can to satisfaction prove that this any white person is a racist unless they admit it, or unless you get some other white people to co-sign and say, yeah, such and such, this white person is a racist, I'm white, and I'm saying so. So I just do it for that reason. The only time I call a white person a racist is if they admit and say, yes, I am a racist, and that's why I've asked many white people on the program, are they a racist? If they admit it, bam, then I just go from that, and I make sure to say that this is an admitted racist, that I'm not just name-calling this person, that they acknowledge that, yes, I do practice racism, white supremacy, but that's my code in terms of why I say suspected racist, and that should not in any way, I hope, take away from my conclusion, firm conclusion, about what it means to be white in a system of racism, white supremacy. I think I've been pretty clear about that for some years now. If you are white under the system of racism, white supremacy, that means racist. That's what that classification is all about, dedicated, committed, not ignorant about racism, white supremacy. I hope that is logical and makes sense.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Thank you. That's all I have to say. I'm you myself.
Sure. Definitely co-sign on the no spot. I think I brought that up before. I think racists are sitting around watching basketball games that's filled with black people. I think that would, in my view, go a long way. We're not going to have another Serena Williams, another LeBron James until this problem has been solved. We're devoting all of our skill and talents towards solving the problem, white supremacy. We're not carrying any of your balls and providing any entertainment for you, athletic or otherwise, until this problem has been taken care of. That, in my view, would be extremely constructive. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you all had commentary. Other folks, anybody else with a hand up that we hadn't heard from? Do y'all have commentary?
Did you say for those who have already said something?
Well, it looked like we had people that just dialed in more recently who had a hand up that we had not heard from.
Okay.
So I was going to try to give them a moment, but I don't know if they if you hit your mute button or if you are just listening or whatever the case may be, but I'll give one last check. They might be waiting for later. I don't know what the issue is, but the people that we haven't heard from, did you all have anything else you wanted to get in? If not, I know Thomas in New York had said he had something else he wanted to share, and seems firefighter did as well. Folks that we haven't heard from?
Good night. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah,
oh, you're a little low. If you could speak up, that would be helpful.
Is that any better?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I was thinking. I was like, that's a interesting perspective on sports about focusing on white supremacy, because me personally, I'm really interested in sports, and I find sports kind of like almost, I would say, meditative, something I would do to kind of de-stress from living through and under white supremacy. And I was also thinking about, I think you guys were talking about medical apartheid. And just living and just, as we're talking about, living under white supremacy, the medical, as this has been terrible, they literally killed my grandmother with drugs and with surgery when she had cancer. I went to the dentist, and basically the man told me that I had a tooth extraction to take my two bottom teeth out and put in false teeth in my head. And I'm like, what you're saying makes no sense. So I had to get a second opinion just to find out that there's nothing wrong with my teeth. You know what I'm saying? My son, I'm going to all these doctors. They're prescribing all these ointments and medications for him that's not doing nothing. And it's just like, you know what I mean? It's like, it's all experimentation. Either they don't know what they're doing, or they don't care, or both. You know what I'm saying? And it's like, I feel like when people, black people, go into like any industry, let it be electronics, nursing, whatever, a skill industry, like when you get in those industries, don't just do that to like just get a job. Like, pass that skill on to another black person, a daughter, a cousin, somebody, just to keep You know what I mean? That skill in the family so we can make a living off of that. You know what I mean? And I think Firefighter was talking earlier about the program that Gus provides. And it's been very, very influential for me in terms of dealing with black people and other non-white people when they don't agree with my definition of racism or how I view racism. It teaches me to, like, listen more and not try to convince people, but just listen, ask questions, and if it's going to be, like, a physical conflict or a confrontation like that, just, you know, I mean, separate. And I really appreciate that with this program, and thank you for letting me share.
For sure. Glad to hear that. Minimizing contact with other victims of racism. Hugely important aspect to counter racism. That right there goes along. That's one of the core aspects of my code as well. If you are any black person and you're around other black people, even non-white people, period, but in particular other black people, if you conclude that you're the person that's least confused about white supremacy, then one of your primary duties, sometimes maybe your only duty, is to make sure that conflict is being minimized. Whatever, if that means that you aren't talking, fine. If that means you're asking questions, fine. If that means that you're just listening, fine. Whatever needs to be done to minimize conflict, that should be one of your primary objectives, because that racist, white supremacist, the way they have set things up, that's going to be one of the main things that happens. That is what they are hoping for and giddy about. Something that starts out, we're supposed to be constructive, or us exchanging information or views on white supremacy, and then it leads, you're Coon, you're Sambo, and name-calling, and that sort of thing. They already know that's very, very likely to happen, just if people have a different perspective, different viewpoint, what should we should be doing to try to solve some of our problems. I did want to say, at least with the sports thing, if it's something that you do that's helpful for you in terms of just being something where you can kind of meditate and use it to detoxify, to de-stress from everything, whatever it is, if it's, you know, you go out and run, or if you play tennis, or play whatever, play basketball, go swimming, whatever it is, for me, that's very different than, like, organized sports, the type of thing that's happening in school. Like, you can do any of those activities on your own, or even if you have, you know, other black friends, and you all go out and do whatever it is that you do that's helpful for you to stay in shape, just for you mentally, to clear your head, that is outstanding. I'm really more so talking about us getting involved professionally and doing this, even if it's not going, you know, NFL or NBA or that sort of thing, but even collegiately, where you're going and invariably you're going to have some white coach and white athletic directors and all of that who's in charge of your child or in charge of you directly, cutting all of that sort of thing out, I think would be hugely constructive. Not saying, you know, you have to give up any of your personal athletic things. If it's constructive for you and something that you enjoy, I think that's great. If people understand the difference between the two.
Yep, thanks. That cleared it up.
Anybody else that we has not shared? Just making sure we didn't miss anybody who did have a hand up. Anybody else who we have not heard from who had commentary they wanted to make sure they got in? I'll assume we got everybody who dialed in with a hand up thus far. I know we had other folks who said they had commentary that they wanted to share as well. Other folks who had comments that they wanted to get in, feel free.
Is that meant for someone who's already commented?
Well, it would have been, but then someone that we hadn't heard from dialed in. Let's see if the caller.
Oh, okay.
The caller.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, Sorry about that. hello, Doug. Hello, everyone. Because unfortunately, I did not follow you from your beginning, but I was wondering if you heard of a book called The Black History of the White House by Clarence Lussain.
What's the book by Clarence Lussain?
The Black History of the White House.
Oh, okay. Got it.
Okay, I wasn't sure whether or not you are familiar with the book, but you talked about white people's reaction to Obama after he leaves the White House, in terms of they may want to change the whole look of the White House after he's gone. But in Clarence Lussain's book, I just want to give you a couple of examples of what happened just before Obama got elected and when he got elected, on the eve that he got elected. So in his book on page 447, he teaches some examples of what was going on. He talked about in October 2008, in Buchanan County, Virginia, McCain became campaign official and local Republican Party treasurer. Bobby May wrote a column stating that Obama selected would paint the White House black, change the national anthem to quote the Negro national anthem, and send more aid to Africa to the Obama family than they can skim enough to allow them to free their goats and live the American dream. And then in October 2008, San Bernardino Republican Women's Club president Diane Fidel, who was later forced to resign, mailed out a newsletter with a cartoon of Obama on a fake food stamp coupon. On the drawing, he was surrounded by ribs, watermelon, fried chicken. And then in February 2009, Republican Mayor Dean Gross of California sent around a photo by email showing the White House in the middle of the watermelon patch with the caption that read, "I put no Easter egg hunt this year." And then it just goes on to say, on the eve that he got elected, within 24 hours of his victory, some students of the North Carolina State University sprayed painted words, quote, "Let's shoot that nigger in the head," and quote, "hang Obama by a noose." The same night, four white men from Staten Island decided to go after black people in response to the election. And before being apprehended, they assaulted two people of color and a white person they believed to be black. Also on the election night, a black family in South Olden, Utah, came home to find that the American flag had been burned. And on that night, a black church in Springfield, Massachusetts was set on fire. According to the Southern Poverty Law Center and research by authors John DeMetto and David DeWert, more than 200, quote, hate-related incidents and actions were documented in the strategic American election of Obama. And the number was doubled by late 2009, although the data is not exact. And my point of bringing this up is that I listen to Trump sometimes, you know, some of his rallies. I don't listen to what he's going to do. I listen because he talks truth about the corruption within the political machine and how it seems to work. And one time he was talking, he said, "Well, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a riot." Well, we know now that the riots have already started. So there's some information coming out from different the black folks saying, "Hey, no, it's going to escalate by the time the election day comes in November. These riots between these white folks, going to escalate," and they say all blacks just need to stay as far back as they can. But I think what's going to happen based on white people getting ready to have, I think it's going to be another civil war. Even if Hillary gets elected, I think it's going to be a riot. So with this in mind, I'm just thinking, I think they're going to come after us again when Obama leaves the office, and then with all the riots that's going to be probably taking place between with Trump and Hillary. Supposed to be a lot of skirmish going on, so I wouldn't be surprised if they do try to burn down the White House or, you know, burn down enough of our houses to make a point that, you know, they did not like the idea that Obama been in the office for 8 years. So I just wanted to make that point, because when you talked about that, I thought about this young man's book, The Black History of the White House. I remember him talking about what had happened just before Obama got elected and getting on the eve of his election. And I just want to mention, too, Dr. Cresswell, she's a brilliant, brilliant woman. She's a brilliant woman. I would never have thought about reconstructive racism. I mean, she stated beautifully, and you know, I just admire her, you know, so much. She's a really brilliant woman. So I just want to thank you for taking my call.
Yes, ma'am. Clarence Lussain has been a guest on the program. We didn't discuss that book. We just—he's written quite a few books, but we discussed Pipe Dream Blues, which is an outstanding book for folks talking about racism and the quote-unquote war on drugs. And we also discussed Hitler's Black Victims, which is about racism, white supremacy, World War II. But outstanding scholarship. I think someone else had recommended that book as well, The Black History of the White House. I'll have to check it out. But yeah, whites, they really showed out all during that election 2008. And it seemed like it was increasing as it led up to the election all across the country. It was just all sorts of incidents like what you mentioned, the attacks. I remember some of that, the coupon that had President Obama on it with like ribs and fried chicken and all that. It was tons of that sort of thing. The watermelon patch at the White House. It was just all sorts of just tackiness happening 2008. And then even I think the night that he was speaking, when he was elected in 2008, he was in Chicago. Some of the Chicago's finest, the police officers, they accosted a black family that was reported, where they maced them in a vehicle and made some tacky comments. It was just tons of it. So, yeah, I would not be surprised if you have repetition of that. And I think I had said this past weekend that I suspect there's going to be an escalation of violence against black people throughout this year, and particularly President-elect Trump, if he does indeed succeed President Obama. I think it's just going to continue. That is what Reconstruction of White Supremacy is all about, in my opinion. You can go back, check out Ben Tillman, Reconstruction of White Supremacy, or any of the other literature that talks about what was happening in terms of what racists were doing against black people during the end of the 19th century, during the period called Reconstruction and post-Reconstruction. Just pay attention to what happened. It was lots and lots of white terrorism, organized, coordinated white terrorism. Other folks have commentary they wanted to make sure they got in. I think we got everybody who dialed in who had a hand up. I think if we did not, you should speak up now, but I think we did nab everybody. But if folks, even if you've already shared, if you have commentary you want to get in, go ahead and feel free to share. The caller 9828, did you have commentary you wanted to share?
Yeah, I was just wanted to comment about like Donald Trump and about a lot of things that's going on with Donald Trump. I just wanted to ask you, do you think, I remember one time I heard Neil before that he was talking about something with Gandhi. I forgot what it was about, but it was about the general over there in India who mowed down a lot of the people over there. And, you know, when it was like, he was saying something about how it's not about the general, but about the system itself. Do you think that with President, who's trying to run for president, Trump, and the lady running for president, Hillary Clinton, do you think, like, between two of them, like, do you think they could probably be, like, the same side of the coin? Like I could be wrong, and, you know, like I said, I am wrong about a lot of things, but in my opinion, I kind of feel like, what's going to happen to us, really, I think what's going to happen to us if Hillary Clinton wins is the same thing that will happen to us if Donald Trump wins. I could be wrong. Like I say, I am wrong about a lot of things, but I just feel like it's a good cop, bad cop game they're playing on us. And I seriously believe that, and it's like different laws they might have that may affect the general public that is not black, in my opinion. But it might affect the general public that's not black. But the stuff that they gonna come down on us with that steel hammer, they gonna come down on us with that steel hammer hard. They gonna come on. They gonna come down. They gonna, as the young folks say, turn up. They gonna turn up on us. If Bernie Sanders, if Hillary Clinton, if Donald Trump get in there, I think the agenda has already been set in stone. You know, I mute my line, but I just want to say my opinion.
Oh, for sure. I definitely totally grasp that. And I think even Dr. Welsing, I think she said numerous times her view, just in terms of us understanding that all, whether it's Republicans, the Democrats, Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump, that these are all just different varieties of racism, white supremacy, and exactly what you said, that it's not going to work out well for black people regardless, whomever ends up there. And even exactly as you said, that a lot of these things, whatever is going to happen, starting with, you know, the inauguration, January 2017, that a lot of this stuff has already been written down in terms of the plans that they have in place for what they want to happen locally, nationally, globally. And that, you know, these are the things that are going to happen regardless of who happens to be sitting in the Oval Office. That, you know, makes total logical sense, in my opinion. For me, it seems like that plan, at least in my view right now, looks like they intend for it to be Donald Trump sitting there. But they absolutely, whatever they have planned to happen, they absolutely could do that, whether he's there or not. Absolutely. That makes total sense, in my opinion.
He's going to win Alabama. He's going to fucking anyway.
For sure. Let's see. If that finished up Alabama, if that finished up your commentary, sir?
Oh, yes, sir. That's all I wanted to add.
Oh, for sure. The caller 9516, did you have a commentary you wanted to get in as well?
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I really didn't even get to listen to, like, all of the show because I was I'm at my family's house, but I didn't even get a chance to listen. But I just wanted, I don't know if you guys talked about Roots. Did you guys talk about Roots tonight?
We didn't bring it up today. No, we did talk about it on the compensatory call-in. I know, I guess it's airing. I saw it was trending online earlier today, so I'm sure some folks have either seen some of it or are watching it or whatever the case may be. Certainly, if that's something that you want to bring up, that's absolutely on time.
Okay. Well, I did listen to the other show the other night that had the Roots on it, and I was, like, really affected. Just listening to the clips of Kunta getting beaten, it just, like, it just did something to me. Like, I had to just listen that. Like, I didn't want to, like, talk or anything. It was just, like, really, really emotional. But then the next day, they had an article in the paper here about Roots and saying why they needed it to come out now. So I guess the guy who did this show before his son now has the right to the show. So people were asking him about doing it again. So he's saying, no, we don't need to do it again or whatever. But when he said, when he talked to his son about the show, he said he had to sit down and make his son literally watch the show. So after the show was over, he watched it. His son said that he gets it and he understands, but it just didn't speak to him. So he said then after that, that's what made him say, hey, we really got to do this show. And the article also was saying how this Roots that they're showing tonight is, like, way worse than the Roots that they showed the very first one. So to me, like, I'm just trying to decode it. And then to me, it's just like he was saying, like, the white supremacy racism should have been, like, kind of good enough. The first one kind of solidified that, like, why do we need to do another one? But then when his son said that he didn't he didn't, he wasn't really down with that. He wasn't, you know, he didn't really, he got it, he understood it, but that didn't really speak to him is what he said. So the, I guess the father was feeling like we really have to, I really have to do this. I really have to amp this. We really have to amp this up. Like, he has to, like, reinforce the racism, white supremacy. So I heard that this one is even worse, and I don't even want to see it. I really don't even want to, I don't even want to see this next one, because it's basically like saying it's way worse. Not just that it's way worse, but like this is gonna, this is like really showing. They said they really gonna show like what was really going on, because they said that whipping scene is longer in this newer version than the other one, and that the newer version whipping scene has like some spikes on the whip or something, so it's like a really much worse beating. I hope I was kind of clear, because like I'm like all over the place. So I hope I was kind of clear, like why, you know, reading the article and what that said about. I just interpreted it as like them like reinforcing the racism, white supremacy. Like it's like taking it up a notch, and because his son said that he didn't, it didn't speak to him. Like it was like his way of saying like I really got to answer this stuff. And that's all I had to say. Thanks.
Has anybody seen any of the new one? I think it was supposed to be airing, to, I guess, depending on the time zone that you're in, it might be on now or whatever the case. Has anybody seen any of the new one yet? I reckon that is a no. I haven't seen any of it either. I did not want to see it. And was pondering, you know, whether I should even make time to view it. I figured that, you know, someone might ask eventually if I have seen it and my thoughts on it. So, you know, I figured I might have to watch it for that purpose. But, you know, I was following the same logic where I did not want to see it. I feel like whites have done a lot of making these slave narratives over the past 5 years or so, with the Book of Negroes and Django and 12 Years a Slave. I'm sure that they even had a French film. I think it's called Part the Case or something like that. But it's these two black males. It's like set present day, and they go back in time to a plantation, and they're abused and mistreated and all this. And then I think they end up saving the life of a white boy on the plantation, and somehow they end up being transported back to the 21st century so that they have an understanding of what their black family members went through, being terrorized. But Part the Case, I think, is the name of it. Part the Case, or something close to that. Anyway, but they've done a lot of these films over the past few years or so, and more to come. The Good Lord Bird is coming out. I think someone had mentioned that, with Will Smith's son is going to be in it. Lots of these films, more to come. I think all of it is to just strengthen, reinforce white supremacy. Plus, I think whites have an affinity for watching these types of films, seeing black people being whipped and raped and beaten. They love it. We've done programs about that, talking plantation fiction. They love that sort of thing. It's great. In my view, it's the same type of thing as all of these videos of black people being terrorized and beaten and tased and choked and all. It's the same type of thing. It's just, I think, torture pornography was the term that Dr. Stein used when she was on the program last week. That's my perception of it. I'm sure some people say, well, hey, you can use this as a tool to teach about racism and what happened if you have younger children. And, you know, that might be the case. But I just think anything, and even I would compare it to what I've said about the reconstruction of white supremacy. I think Pam and many others, I think even Dr. Umar has said this sort of thing. This is what we intend to do. We want to go back to this period of time under racism, white supremacy, where we could just do what we want to our niggers. This is the way that we want things to be, and we want to go back to this era. This is what this whole period of reconstruction is about, going back to this earlier time period of more blatant, intense white terrorism. See, the person, I think this is Roz. Do you have commentary? I guess if we had anybody who has seen any of the New Roots Project, if you want to chime in, that would be good as well, if you can comment to what you've seen. But if not, that's fine too. Roz, did you have commentary?
Yes, greetings to you, Gus, and to all the callers and the listeners. I haven't actually seen the new Roots. I have the TV on the station, but I'm not really paying attention to it. But I don't know. It's really interesting about the whole Roots thing because I don't know if you got to see, but I sent you an article where Snoop Dogg went off on a tirade about this new Roots movie and that he wants people to boycott for the same reasons that basically you and the other female were saying. Essentially, we don't need to see, you know, another film about us being denigrated to the point of being forced into slavery. And he was angry. He was cursing throughout the whole thing. But essentially, it was the same reasoning. It's just resurrection of these same ideas to reinforce in the minds of the masses of white people what form of white supremacy that they want to go back to. And I think Donald Trump kind of leads the pack with that. I was thinking as well, too, that President Obama and his family are out of the White House, I could see them doing a whole redecorating campaign because, you know, they probably wouldn't even want to touch the bed that they laid in or sit in the chair that he sat in. I could just see, like, such extremes that could possibly come out after he actually leaves the White House as far as how they might treat the White House. So when you were speaking about that earlier, it definitely resonated. Also, when I believe it was a firefighter in Florida, he was talking about the show. And I think the work you do, I'll definitely echo Thomas in New York as far as just your punctuality, your credibility, your respectability, the way you hold the show down and make sure that the parameters are as far as just the conduct on the show, whether it's the people calling in or the people that are on the show. It's just very different from anything that I've listened to, and I do listen to other Blog Talk Radio shows, but this one is just on a different level, and it really reminds me, just because I studied African history so long, it just reminds me of the days when we held ourselves to the highest standards. Like, the things that we look at other races for now as far as just maybe the quality of some of the stuff that they put out there or the fact that they open on time, all of these things were things that we were renowned for until we encountered white supremacy. And I think a lot of us as black people, we get so used to dealing with subpar everything whenever it's something that sadly a lot of us are involved in. We don't always carry it with the same importance. When you speak about the importance of respecting people's time, respecting your own time and energy, and focusing on using that time in a constructive manner, I think a lot of us, because it's been my experience too throughout life, that a lot of times when I deal with certain things organized by our people, it's just, you know, it's not always the greatest experience. And I think sometimes we can get so acculturated psychologically to that kind of experience that it has a profound effect when someone has that kind of ancestral black self-respect that we were known for. And that's what I kind of see this program as. What it taught me was essentially the importance of words and language. And to listen to you in all of the different interviews and conversations and your mental dexterity, your use of words, precise use of words, is something that really had a profound effect on me and just helping me to really fine-tune my own use of language. And it was something that I remember my wife spoke about, my son spoke about, and now that they understand me a lot better, they understand why I speak how I do. But at first it was a little disconcerting for them because they'd never really heard me speak in the way that I do now. And I just had to explain that to her, and I said that this program had a profound effect on that. Even before I read Neely Fuller's work, it was listening to you and listening to the conversation of the other people that call in who are less confused and who also understand what codified language is about in reference to racism, white supremacy, and just in all facets of life in which we choose to have conversations about the different areas of people activity. And I think that is one of the most profound aspects of the program, is that alone. I think it's like really a teaching tool for how to function in a highly codified manner and a very precise, non-emotional manner. And I think that's something that we don't get to experience too often, because for many of us, that's just our general reaction, which sometimes is warranted. Racism is such a violent and volatile system that it can, you know, definitely conjure an emotional response. But I think to hear you not have that kind of emotional response and be very precise, logical, and basically scientific in your approach to dealing with the system of white supremacy. It really helps to give other people a nice example of what that looks like, and something to maybe strive towards emulating, or like having the book club being able to read some of those books that help shape your understanding of the system and the way that it works. All of those things are just highly important for us to really make headway in fighting the system. Speaking about medical apartheid, it really made me think about something that happened to my wife after my son was born. She had an emergency C-section, and after my son was born, he actually just turned 21 on the 26th of May, but when he was born, they didn't actually clean her womb properly, so she ended up developing candida, which is like a yeast infection, and it spread from the actual incision to her armpits, and it was just really, really bad. And I raised a whole lot of hell in the hospital because I'd never seen anything like it. And I've been around a lot of volatile things and a lot of bloody situations, but literally that experience soured me on the smell of blood. Like, now I get nauseous, and it wasn't like that before this experience. And it was really, really bad, and it really taught me after reading this book just the fact that, and I wanted to put it out there too, when you do have to have any sort of I would say traumatizing experience in the hospital, whether it's surgery of some sort, or anything that might cause the body trauma, just to be aware of the importance of cleanliness and making them aware of making sure that if there is a wound of some sort, that is cleaned properly, because a lot of times the hospital carries so many different diseases, and a lot of people die just picking up things from the hospital itself. And reading this book made me think about that experience with my wife, and just wanted to put that out there. And then lastly, I wanted to talk about the Black Panther. It's weird because I used to read those comic books when I was a younger person, and my sister used to collect them. I used to collect them, and there weren't that many, but they were profound to me in the sense that it showed a black superhero that was pretty much uncompromising and had the ability to hold his own with other people that were supposedly superhuman in some genetically altered fashion, and him being a regular person with these exceptional abilities really resonated with me quite a bit as the Black Panther series developed. As far as like the cartoon and things like that, it gave me more insight to the Black Panther's background. And I remember Dr. Nayana Rasayan, who actually talked about that series on the show at one point. And when I got to see it, I just found it to be exceptionally profound, and it gave me a nice insight to white supremacy in the sense that in the cartoon series, I believe it's like an 8-part series. I actually bought it on DVD, but I believe they have it on YouTube. And he actually fights with Captain America, and Captain America is scientifically, genetically altered by some serum that they inject him with to give him the powers that he has. And the Black Panther literally just cleans his clock in no time flat, in a way that Captain America had never been beaten. And it just, when my son saw it, he came to me and said, Dad, it's really interesting that what Captain America had to take a drug enhancement to attain, black people had naturally, and that using our natural ability, we were able to suppress this genetically enhanced white person. And I said, very, very codified way of looking at the cartoon. And it just gave me insight to what white people understand about us. They studied us for so many thousands of years now that they know that we are the ultimate expression of what the Creator meant when they said, let us make God man after our image and our likeness, and that they are a genetic recessive variant of that, and that they are not and will never be and can't be equal to us on a genetic level. So it just really gives insight to the psychology of white supremacy. And I guess it'll be interesting to see what this movie is going to put up, what it's going to present when it's put out there. I'm not going to spend any money on it in the theater, so I'll wait till enough time passes where I can either see it for free or for extremely cheap. But I just want to say thank you for taking my call, guys, and thank you for the show.
Hey, Gus, can I ask something real quick?
Yes, sir.
It just was an idea that I was thinking about, and I was thinking about how, you know, a lot of people are getting tired of, like, you know, slave movies and The Help, and, you know, even movies about slavery, like The Help, The Butler, you know, all these type movies. And, you know, me myself, I would like to see movies about the Empire dynasty and the Empire of Carthage, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, I look at all these groups on Facebook, you know, and I see these groups, they get started very quick. Like, they're getting very fast, like 35,000 people. Some of them got like 160,000 people, you know, and it is like these groups are numbers, you know, with 100,000, 6,000 people. And I just wonder if each one of these, you know, quote-unquote conscious groups or whatever, just asks each one of their members for $1 every 6 months. You know, that's $2 a year, you know. With all of those collective groups coming together as a fist for one big film every year, it could be done. I mean, my life. That's all I want to say.
I think there is starting to be more of that. I know people have been talking about that, and I mean, even the budget consideration has changed dramatically just over the last 10 years with all of the technology in terms of computers and the internet. And I mean, you have all these web series now. I mean, I suspect that's going to look radically different over the next 20 years in terms of the type of products that are produced in terms of entertainment. I mean, it's going to be dramatically easier if folks, you know, really say, hey, I'm tired of seeing these. We can make our own film project where you could make something and have it on YouTube or another streaming service or what have you. You could do it if you want to give it out for free or if you want to make it a subscription service. I know people are talking about that as well. Vicus having something that's similar to like to Netflix where you could pay like a monthly subscription fee and having black content that's made by black directors, black writers and what have you. I mean, all of that stuff should look dramatically different. And I know on the continent that's growing as well, where they're having their trying to set up their own streaming services and making their own types of film and television content and what have you. So that sort of thing, some of that is already happening, and it should be, I mean, just a dramatic increase in that sort of thing, I would say, over the next 20 years as all of that technology continues to evolve and it just becomes easier and cheaper to do that sort of thing.
Yeah, I heard about you was talking about it was African-American company, black company, you know, that had something like Netflix. I think I heard you mention that on one of your broadcasts you had.
Yep, people have been talking, looking at doing something like that and having exclusive content, kind of the same way that Netflix, they have content that's exclusive to Netflix. I think House of Cards is one. I think they have some others as well, but doing the same thing, having content that is exclusive to a black subscription service. So should be more of that to come, and I know people are having more ideas for that sort of thing. So, yeah.
But I'm thinking about all the numbers from all those groups. I can't get that out of my head. All those numbers from all those, conscious groups. All those numbers, how many millions of dollars that'll be every 6 months, you know, for like a blockbuster film with like computer graphics. And it could go through anybody, but I just can't get that in my head. It's like, to me, it would make logical sense with PayPal and all these other things. Now, people like me, I think it'll be, those are the people you're going to have a problem with, people like me, and I'm the first to admit it. Folks that are scared to go on the internet and, you know, purchase things, buy things, but never purchased nothing off the internet before. You see what I'm saying? But getting the old people, you know, to get in line, you know, once you got them in line, I think everything else will fall in hand. And like you say, people are doing things. Now I see you said on one show, you promote and now subscribe to them. I forgot they're on YouTube. I haven't watched them in a while, but they had shows coming on all the time when it was like in the office. You remember their name?
40 Hours and an Unwritten Rule. I think that's the one you might be talking about. It's a black female. She had a series where it was about racism in the workplace, that a black female was the main character, racism she was experiencing.
I got to check it out. Right now, my son is kind of running bad. I got to check it out, and then I'll let you know. They good shoes coming on, too, but I'm in my line and let other people talk, and I'm just running on. Sorry about that.
No apologies. But, yeah, and even the last point that you made, I think it's probably going to be fewer people who are in the category of having never made an Internet purchase over the next 20 years. I suspect it'll be a smaller and smaller number of those folks who have not made a purchase online, or you just have more and more people that have done that. That's routine. They've done it before. They're not intimidated about that. So that'll be shrinking. And then also having methods that are in place for people who are not comfortable with that. If it's having a mailing address where they can mail something, or having an alternative, that way they can still invest or support whatever it is you're doing, even if they're not comfortable just going online with, you know, a debit card or a credit card or whatever it happens to be to invest in the project. But, yeah. Did anybody else, because I know the Roots thing was raised, anybody else have any commentary that they wanted to add to the Roots project, if you've seen it, or even if you haven't seen it, just if you wanted to get in anything on what's happening with the Roots, the new Roots series? Even that, I did want to make sure that I say, I saw the commercial today on television. They're starting to advertise for that 7-hour documentary that's going to be on ESPN starting within a few days on O.J. Simpson. And that's another thing that's been a big part of this project, having the menacing killer Negro who maligned this white woman. I think that's a part of the reconstruction aspect, too. But they just had the O.J. Simpson, the People vs. O.J. Simpson. They just had that. Now they're having this documentary. I think even that is subtle with this new Roots project, because O.J. Simpson was in the original Roots series, if folks recall. But anybody else have commentary they want to add in on the new Roots film?
Oh, gosh. Can I just chime in on what you just said?
Sure.
I was going to say, when you brought up O.J. Simpson, him being in the film, the one that just finished recently, and the upcoming 7-hour documentary, it kind of brings me back to that old adage that black men are raping and killing white females and we have to come to their rescue. So it's kind of like resurrecting that same, I guess, age-old white supremacist tactic of rabid black males running around lusting after white women. And he's like the quintessential example of the danger of white females messing around in any way, shape, or form with a black male. So all of this, like you said, I truly believe is going in exactly that direction. And it also, Dylan Stormroof, again, you know, made his statement, "I have to kill you because, you know, black men are raping white females," was one of the reasons he put out there. So this is just, it's just like a redux of all of this nonsense. I was mentioning the other day, they have the Tarzan movie coming out, which is and one scene, they have like these thousands of silverback gorillas helping Tarzan fight these colonists that were in the jungle. And I was telling my son that these apes represent black people. And he said, "I totally agree with you." So it's just this redux of either stupid black people being led by this one white male who's the quarterback of the movie, to so to speak, or just the brutalization of black people during slavery, or just anything to just denigrate the black female. I mean, it's just insane. Like, it's just the same thing. It's like they're running out of themes. So the movies that were so successful in the past, I believe they're perfecting them as far as just the message they're putting out there and the visual quality of that message based on the updated technology. That's what I see it as, because all of these movies, they did King Kong a few years back with Jack Black in it and Naomi Watts, and it was the same thing. It was the perfection of the whole King Kong ideology. So I think you're absolutely right, and I just wanted to chime in with that. Thank you.
What I notice about a lot of movies, they copy them almost identical to the original. I don't see any difference between the Roots back when I was in college and the Roots that's about to come out right now. What makes it different is it is new to another generation. The white supremacists are very scientific at their ability to reproduce something because they know it's going to affect not necessarily me, because if they're, you know, if from just hearing my attitude about it, you know, you kind of like can figure out on what I think about it. But a generation that have really didn't pay attention to the one that was done back in 1977. They really wouldn't identify with it, but you can do the same thing almost to the letter. I think I heard one clip that is almost exactly like it was with Trevor Burton when the slave breaker was beating him and forcing him to call out his slave name instead of Kunta Kinte. It's basically the same thing. And with the idea, and they probably don't really care if they get the same reaction out of the non-white black viewers or not. And not just this movie, there's been countless numbers of movies that they have copied over and for that same purpose. So that's my thoughts on it. I don't see anything, you know, really different going on with it, and therefore it's not going to be any constructive answers to whatever they're trying to produce. Thank you.
For sure.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. I just wanted to double check because, well, go ahead. Yes, ma'am. We can hear you. Go ahead.
I just wanted to ask the other caller, is he actually watching it? Did he see it? Did he see any part of it?
I don't think anybody that's dialed in thus far has said that they've seen any of it. I haven't seen any of it. And when I asked earlier if anybody had seen any of it, nobody spoke up. So unless I'm mistaken, I don't think anybody here has seen any of it thus far.
I guess I just wanted, like, the article that I was reading in the paper here in Milwaukee was saying that it's worse. Like, the article, in so many words, is saying, like, the scenes are worse. Like, they were saying, like, we are really going to show, like, what was really going on at that time. Like, they were saying that when they showed the other roof, like, they kind of softened it up. So that's why they made the comparison with the two beating scenes. Like, now they have, like, some hooks or something on the whip. Like, it's going to be even worse, and the scene is even longer. So I guess that's how they're vamping it up. And then I'm thinking about, like, you know, now they have, you know, the newer actors. And so now the newer generation is seeing it. So now they're going to, they know, they recognize it. Like, oh, I know all these different people. They recognize all these different people, you know, that they see. And so it's like they're not going to be, now they're going to be more interested in seeing it because they see people that they already know that are, you know, in these movies. So this just kind of further reinforces that way. But I don't recommend anybody watching it.
The caller on the vote line, did you have a comment you wanted to get in?
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. My computer's been acting funny, so I don't know if you can hear me. I just agree with what everyone said with your professionalism, not just of you, but of the other callers. And I guess something I wanted to bring up, and we've been talking about it with the movies and stuff, kind of how, and I think it's been said in the past, how the white supremacy culture is a culture of violence. That's probably one of the reasons they are redoing these, not just this movie with Roots and making it more violent, but, I mean, just redoing Westerns, making them, everything they do over, kind of show you this is what we're about. And I think someone else brought up the point about them needing, I guess, additional help to, I guess, defeat black people or whatever. You know, that's another thing that runs in their movies. Is, I guess there was this movie and TV show called Limitless, which is the same thing. The guy, the white guy, is dumb till he takes a pill, and all of a sudden he's a genius. I guess that's just how they operate. And I guess to circle back to talk about the school in Idaho, I kind of looked at that little town, and you were right, but it said the population of black was like 3.6 whatever percentage was. I did the math, and it was about 11 people. And that sounds like everyone this couple adopted, because they seem like you said they adopted like 20 people. So almost everyone they've adopted counts as this non-white or black population. And how just insensitive and this stupid they are to not, I guess they think, you know, white people think because they're white, they know everything. They don't even think about bringing their child, bringing any child into that environment. And also, according to Wikipedia, the population of that town is very young, because almost half the town, they said, was under 18, if you just go by the statistics. So, you know, we have to be careful, because it seems like that town may be breeding a culture. I mean, I know other areas are, but that town definitely is breeding a culture of white supremacy if these young people are quote-unquote split about what's going on, because any violence to anyone in this way would be wrong. Thank you.
For sure. Before, there were two other people I wanted to make sure I got their comments in as well. Our caller in Michigan, she wrote in. She had two questions. Her first question was, make sure I'm getting it correct. Her first question was, how many non-white people do you think will be needed? How many non-white people do you think need to be codified to see the effects? In order to ultimately solve the problem of racism, white supremacy, I'm not sure what that number would be. I know we don't have enough now, but... I'm not sure what it would need, what the like percentage or like an exact global number would be. Whatever it is, we don't have enough currently. I know Mr. Fuller, I think the term he uses is the quantum number of people that you would need to be acting in a codified manner. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they all have to have the exact same code, but just understanding, having a better grasp of what white supremacy is, and then adjusting their thought, speech, action, and emotional responses to that to be more codified to solve this problem. We don't have it. I know on a smaller level, just to begin to see some of the impact, if you just have one codified person, that can be enough to begin to see effects. And I've seen that personally, repeatedly, just if you have one non-white person who is being codified and how they talk about racism, how they treat other black people, how they speak to white people, that can have a huge impact with just other non-white people see that. And it changes the way that they think, where they start saying, hey, I need to do some of that. I need to ask, you know, figure out some questions to ask these white people. I need to be a little bit more suspicious. I need to be careful about how I treat other black people and trying to be courteous to them. I've seen where one person can be enough to have an impact if other non-white people see that individual being codified on a consistent basis. That's the key, too, if you are consistent about it, where it's not, I'm codified today, and then tomorrow I come in and I'm, you know, calling everybody Sambo and Coon and what have you. If you're consistent about it, that can have a big impact. I've also seen if it is like several non-white people are in an area and are being codified, like, oh, man, that can have just huge impact, where I've been fortunate where we, myself and other victims of racism, where we went to like a seminar where they were supposed to be talking about racism, and we even pretended that we didn't know each other. So it was like four or five of us, and we all sat in different places. It's not like we were all sitting together like we knew each other. So everybody thought that, you know, we just came individually. We didn't know each other. So we were all asking questions and that sort of thing. And I mean, it had a huge, it changed the whole course of the meeting, just having like three or four individuals. And it was like, it was more than 20 people there, but just having three or four codified non-white people, huge impact on how the meeting evolved, what was said about racism, people being more cautious, people asking for definitions of racism, huge impact. So I would say just on an individual level, one can be enough to see an impact. And in terms of greater impact, in terms of actually solving this problem, I'm not sure, but whatever it is, we don't have enough. We need a lot more, many, many more to answer your questions. Hope that was clear. Oh, she had one more question. Her other question was, since all white people are not ignorant about racism, white supremacy, are they all codified in their practice? I would say yes. Just in my view, some are more codified than others. I think Mr. Fuller has said as well that white supremacy is united and dependent as well, meaning each individual white person, they have to a certain degree, they have their own freedom in terms of how they want to go about practicing racism. So their code might differ. For some whites, their code is, I sexually terrorize black people, whether I'm a white woman or a white man. That's what I do. That's part of my code. For some white people, I don't do that. I don't want to be around these niggers. I'm just going to be an enforcement official and beat them and handcuff them and whatever the case may be. For other whites, it might be I'm just going to go in a lab and concoct some drugs and chemicals that we can dump in their water and mess Flint up or whatever the case. I mean, they have their individual code for how they're going to go about doing it. So it doesn't necessarily have to be the same. I would say that they all are codified. Some are more refined, some are more explicit. They have a different way of going about their business of practicing racism, but the fundamental underlying goal is the same worldwide. It allows for a lot of freedom. I mean, that just seems to be very obvious. It allows for a great degree of united, independent action about how you're going to go about maintaining white domination. And you even see white people get in conflict with each other about that from time to time. Not enough to disrupt the business, but at least in my view, you do see whites sometimes they'll be arguing about, you know, what we should do in terms of how we manage our business operation of world domination. But yes, I think all whites are codified about racism. They just have a different code. It's not all the same, which is the same. We should copy that. Our code doesn't have to be the same as victims of racism about how we codify, how we go about trying to solve this problem. Hope that makes sense. Thomas in New York, did you want to comment? Should be with us, Thomas in New York. Were you going to comment or are you just listening?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, good evening. I had my phone on mute. I apologize. Yes, I wanted to, man, that statement you made about making all the slave movies, trying to put us back into that era of Reconstruction, and we were going through it, man, that was excellent, man, correlation between those two things. I didn't even think of it like that. Man, Roz kind of hit on what I wanted to say about the Black Panther. What I wanted to say was, you know, first I want to say it's good to see a black superhero. Superman, Batman, Spider-Man, all other men's and women's and all of the, you know, for the most part are white. And here this guy goes, he's just as good as the white superheroes, whether they've been mutated or aliens, you know, like Superman or whatever. And his number one source of power is melanin. It's all natural. And I'm a firm believer that, and I believe white people who study it believe it too, that, you know, the last perfect society we had on this planet was ancient Kemet. And people there were extremely powerful because they were in their right mind. And they weren't dealing with racism, white supremacy. And they had a whole culture and society based around all types of, you know, magical people, sort of like the superheroes. If you, you know, listen to the story of the guy. And,
your volume, your audio got distorted. Not able to hear you.
Sorry, is this better?
Okay, yes, now we can hear you.
Okay, yeah, I was saying he's like, you know, coming back from the unscathed part of Africa that was never touched by the white supremacists, where they're all in their right mind, which is Wakanda, and he's harnessed all these great skills and knowledge just using his melanin and his in-tuneness with nature. And, you know, here he is. He's able, like Rod said, to defeat the synthetic melanated, Captain America. You know, they put a synthetic form of melanin in him to give him his powers, and it just doesn't work. So, I mean, I think that it's great, and I think it's going to be great when we see all the little kids with the Black Panther book bags and lunch boxes and sneakers and T-shirts this summer and next year when they go to school and supposed to see a Superman and a Spider-Man. I just wish that we made it. It was a black, you know, instead of Marvel. But, you know, I think it's good. And I mute my line on that.
For sure. I know in the comic book he does have a section at the end, Mr. Coates, where He encourages feedback in terms of what people would like to see. He wants it to be very open to, you know, things that you don't like or things that you like or how you want it to evolve. So if you get the comic or you check it out or what have you, just go to the end and you'll see there's an email address set up for it. So you can, once you've read an issue or two, you can write in with your feedback about what you thought about it. So the caller at 5992, we pretty much did our 3 hours, so this will probably be our last comment for today. 5992, did you have commentary you wanted to get in? Not hearing you. I don't know if you muted your line or not. 5992, are you with us?
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, I didn't look at Roots, but my position is I'll watch Roots or any other, you know, show they want to, you know, betray us in if they show us revolting. I think it's important that our people be able to see that we revolt. Put Nat Turner in there or put Harriet Tubman in the movie and and then I will consider watching it. And then I'm hopeful that a lot of black people in this country, because in the past years we had so many master educators like Attorney Automatic, Dr. Ben, Dr. Clark, Dr. Dia, so many of them has educated us in terms of white race, racism and white supremacy, beside Mr. Fuller and Dr. Francis Chris Rubbing. So I'm just hoping that, you know, blacks are more aware now than they was in the 1970s of what's going on. And I too hope that they do not watch this show tonight. And I just want to add something about the book I made reference to, the Black History of the White House. I was so impressed after I read the book. I showed it to like 7 black people and hope they would read the book. And what they did, they took pictures of the cover. And then when I went back to them, you know, a month or two later and asked them if they read the book, they told me no, but they were impressed enough to take pictures of the cover of the book, which is very nice. I just wanted to add that.
Fine on. I think Nat Turner, I don't know if he, I saw the original Roots, I haven't seen the new one, but I know the Nat Turner insurrection is referenced in both of the films, even though you do not see Nat Turner in the first one, so I would assume you probably don't see him in this one either, but they do reference what happened in Southampton, Virginia, in, I think, both of the films. And then even The Birth of a Nation is coming out later this year, and that is all about Nat Turner. That's just another one from this era of history, even though a black person, Nate Parker, did do that film. That would be a cowbell as well. Anywho, we should be back at minimum on Thursday. I have to check my calendar to make sure I'm not missing one of the broadcasts we had before then. But minimum, we'll be here on Thursday for Workplace Racism, New Time, a segment moving from being a part of the compensatory call-in to standing on its own. It'll be weeklies every Thursday, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Workplace Racism, feel free, looking forward. I'm hoping that, if anything, there should be more participation because there were people who said specifically that it was on too late as a part of the compensatory call-in. We normally didn't start until 11. A little after 11 Eastern for that portion of the program. So hopefully it being on at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific will make it easier for more people to participate, give their thoughts, experiences, workplace racism. 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. It'll be this Thursday as its first time being its own segment. Again, if you have problems, questions, gripes, guest suggestions, feel free. Drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. If you see anything as it relates to Roots or any of the other things that we've discussed, seems like a myriad of things during the program, feel free, and we'll try to add clarification. Certainly medical apartheid, if, you know, I would encourage folks, you should read the book, but if you want to be a part of the book club, this Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, halfway point of the book, we are in Chapter 8, eugenics, control, reduction of black population. Great information, outstanding counter-racist material. You should definitely read the book, and if you're interested, tune in Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific. With that, thank you kindly for all the folks tuning in. You could have been at a barbecue, having fun, doing your thing. Hopefully it was a constructive investment. If you had the day off, I know everybody did not, but if you did have the day off from the plantation, I hope it was a constructive investment of your time and energy. Again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. You certainly do not want to make racists' job easier. In fact, we had a listener in South Africa emailed me, was saying that they have such a big problem with alcoholism in South Africa. That was actually one thing that I am not ignorant about. That is something, because I do listen to some of the talk radio programs that they have in South Africa. Rini Klabi, she has a great program where they regularly talk about white supremacy in that part of the world, and they did like a whole big segment. It was more than an hour where they were talking about how quote-unquote apartheid produced such a high rate of alcoholism amongst black people there because they had so little opportunity, so little resources. Like, that was the one thing or one of the few things that they would allow to have black people in the little shanty town rent places. They could have their little juke joints, basically. And so you had black people who just sit and drink alcohol all day in their depression about being terrorized. But it, much like what happened with quote-unquote Native Americans, and even to a degree, in my opinion, what's happened with cannabis here, that you have high rates of black people with alcoholism in South Africa. And he was emailing about that in connection to white supremacy. But sobriety would be best. That's one thing that we could do from an economic standpoint, to not give whites, racists, any money for their toxins, and just to not make their job easy. Particularly if you're going to be in a vehicle, passenger, driver, even as a pedestrian, you do not want Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson pulling you over with the flashing lights where you are intoxicated. Let's make sure that we can make outstanding decisions to keep ourselves as safe as possible, you and anybody that you might be responsible for. Sobriety would be best, and certainly buckle up if you're going to be in a vehicle. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with enforcement officers. That's it. We'll be back at a minimum this coming Thursday. Thanks again for tuning in. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.